morning, everybody. Today is September 13th, Thursday. I'd like to call to order the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy.
And I will call the House Committee on Healthcare to order on this fine day.
Just to let you know, the first part of the meeting, we will be covering coordinated care organizations and the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. And then the Senate Committee will be moving to Hearing Room E to finish the Senate agenda. And the House will remain here to continue and finish their agenda. But with that, I would like to call Bruce Goldberg and Mike Bonetto up to give us an update on coordinated care organizations. I already called you up.
This is my recurrent nightmare.
Yes, we start on time.
You're talking on coordinated care organizations.
And you're wearing all your clothes.
Thank goodness.
And I did call Mike Bonetto up too, but he can stay in the front row if he wants to.
Okay. Good morning for the record. You know who I am, although I'm a moment late. Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority, here to talk with you briefly this morning about an update on CCOs and Oregon's health reform. It's hard to believe that it's been about 6-7 months since we ended session at the end of February, passed fairly historic legislation to implement dramatic health reform in the Oregon Health Plan, really creating the CCOs. In that 6-7 month period, we have, number one, negotiated a new waiver with CMS, a process that generally takes about 2 years, got it done by July 1. We had over a $1 billion procurement for the state, putting out RFAs for these new CCOs and setting up a procurement process that took place rather rapidly over about a 4-month period. And I'm here today to tell you that as of September 1, we have 13 CCOs operational in just about all parts of the state. We have 3 more that have been provisionally certified, and once they meet a variety of additional requirements, they will be certified and be able to care for members. What that means is that as of today, there are approximately 500,000 of the 650,000 people on the Oregon Health Plan who are getting their care through a CCO. That's 75% of the Oregon Health Plan population. I don't want to underestimate the transition issues that have gone on over the last several months. Contracting issues, information system issues, MMIS, patient assignments, being able to be certain that people got 500,000 people were assigned to the right plan, that the budgets for all these plans were set, and that the dollars for all of those 500,000 people got to the right place at the right time. We worked really hard, and CCOs worked really hard. We collaborated really well, and I would say that things went relatively smoothly. We're watching things very closely, and we'll certainly continue to do that. But a lot of the transition issues have gone relatively smoothly. I wouldn't say there's been absolutely no problems. There always are some issues. And I always remind everybody that we are day 44 for the oldest CCOs, and we're day 13 for the newest. And so that means that we're still dealing with some transition issues. There's certainly I would say that There are some issues about provider panels, and that there are some providers in communities around the state that would like to be a part of CCOs, but don't at this point in time have contracts. That means that there are some patient continuity issues and some workforce issues in communities, and I think that over the next few months those are issues that we're certainly going to work through. A lot of work's been done by all the CCOs and by everybody over the last several months just to get to the point that we are today. One of the places where there has been a variety of issues that I just want to touch on briefly has been the integration and coordination of oral health and dental care with CCOs. And there have been three issues that have really arisen. I'll just go through briefly. One is governance, one is timing, and a third is whether a CCO can provide its own dental network. In terms of governance, statute was pretty clear in terms of governance, saying that representation had to be from the major components of the healthcare system. You as legislators only specified two specific types of providers, one a primary care clinician and the other an addiction and behavioral health clinician. Other than that, there was no specification of what a major component was. And quite frankly, we've left that up to communities to really define. I think that some of the DCOs have wanted to have that kind of representation. We know that 7 of 13 of the current CCOs actually have a dentist or a DCO representative as part of their governance. And our goal is to really promote a smooth and an orderly transition. And I think that's a good start. In terms of networks and timing, what the statute says is that on or before July 1, 2014, a CCO has to have a formal contractual relationship with a DCO. And the statute was crafted that way because some of the DCOs really wanted a period of time to be able to make a transition and deal with a lot of the unique issues around oral health care to coordinate into community-based global budgets, etc. But the statute allowed an opportunity for communities and for DCOs that were wanting to go quicker to be able to go quicker. That's why it says on or before July 1, 2014. Once a CCO and a we're required to continue to contract with DCOs until through 2014. Once, however, a CCO and a DCO enter into a contract, we will no longer contract with that DCO for dental care. Rather, we contract with that CCO for dental care. It will mean amending the contract with that CCO, getting approval from the feds for that new array of services, having a CCO need to demonstrate that it has the capacity and the network to deliver oral health services. Our sense is that it's likely it will do that, and having a contract with a DCO, that they'll do it in conjunction with that DCO. But at that point, certainly a CCO could hire some additional dentists of its own to help provide oral health care. So we're working through those issues, and I think the last piece that we're trying to do is, again, I think promote sort of an orderly transition and coordination and cooperation. We've got a work group of DCOs and CCOs working together right now on a memorandum of understanding that we're going to ask all CCOs and DCOs to have in place by November. And what that memorandum of understanding is going to be is laying out the ways in which CCOs and DCOs will work together in sharing care for the common members that they have, sharing information, sharing clinical management, how they're going to deal with people who end up in emergency departments with abscesses and access to dental care issues and all the kinds of things where there needs to be good coordination. And our hope is that that will be a really important step into really bringing together the kind of coordination in communities. If, however, a DCO and a CCO want to go beyond that MOU and want to contract together, we will give them an opportunity to do that beginning in November. For some, that's too soon. For others, it's too late. I will say that, and I've talked to many of you about this, as I indicated, doing a lot of the back office function of information systems, member assignments, all those things has been a large task. And I made a clear decision to focus first and foremost on getting the physical health, mental health, CCOs up and going. And put the integration of the dental care off till January because of a lot of the information system issues. It's another layer of complication, quite frankly, in a very complicated process that had probably the most aggressive timelines that anyone's experienced in terms of applying for an RFP, signing contracts, getting up and going. And my judgment was it would make a lot of sense to get the first steps right. I think we've done that now. We've got an orderly transition. And to then layer in the next sort of components of our community-based delivery system. And I think we can do that, quite frankly, in a very orderly and good fashion starting in January. The last piece that I would just touch on is metrics and outcomes. A lot of interest in that. Obviously, we're holding CCOs accountable for a couple things. On one hand, they're being held accountable for this global budget, and that global budget is risk-adjusted according to the population. We've been risk-adjusting managed care capitation and have experience in doing that for the last 10 years. And we're using the same system to be certain that a community that might have a higher medical risk, that their global budget is adjusted compared to another community. So the CCOs are being held to this global budget, but the other thing that they're being held to is metrics and outcomes. We have a metrics and outcomes committee, scoring committee, that is now up and has met a couple of times. That group, as specified by statute, has 9 members, 3 representatives from CCOs, 3 experts in metrics and outcomes, and 3 members at large. We had a transitional group working on metrics over the last 6 months. We couldn't seat this scoring committee because we didn't have a CCO until August 1. But we had a group working on it. We have some provisional metrics. I will send you a list of them. And what the group is working on right now, and we're working not just with the group but with CMS, is how we can create not just what the metrics are, but the appropriate payment systems that begin to reward and pay for care based on performance and meeting metrics, not just simply on quantity. And I think, as we've all discussed, one of the goals in CCOs is to move from a system where, and I think it's a goal in all of healthcare, to move from a system that's based on quantity to a system that pays based on performance. And we're looking to set up a system with the CCOs that does that. It's been a very, very strong interest of the feds to do that. And in fact, part of our agreement with them in the waiver and in getting not only the waiver but the dollars associated was to have a payment system that paid not just based on quantity but based on outcomes. And the reason for that, I think, is sound, and what we all want is if we're holding organizations to this global budget, the fear is that one of the easiest ways to remain within a budget is to just simply not provide care. And so we need to marry a budget with a strong system that's able to assure that not only are we staying within the budget, but that there are true and real incentives for or consequences for not performing well. And so we have until November 5th to work out a system with the feds on that. It was actually one of the requirements of our waiver. And we're working with this metrics group and CMS, and we have some national experts. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has helped support this because I'll tell you, there is an incredible amount of interest from all across the country in what we're doing. And it really gets at, I think, one of the last issues is transparency. And I think one of the issues that I think we can all, I think, rest assured with is that there are a lot of eyes watching this. We're trying to do what I think no state has done, and what every state would like to do, and what every employer would like to do, which is create a sustainable cost trend, improve quality, and improve health. We've got a plan to do that. There's a lot of people watching us, and what's great is we're also getting a lot of help from a lot of experts. So let me stop there and take whatever questions you might have.
Representative Thompson.
I'm still hearing a lot of angst about the lack of inclusion of some of the diverse providers in the primary care system, specifically naturopaths and chiropractors, among others. If these people are willing to work at the top of their license, where's the constriction coming? Why are we just not having the discussion about getting them midfield?
Representative Thompson, co-chair Thompson, co-chairs, chair, members of the committee. This has been an issue, and I think I alluded to it in terms of some of the provider contracting. And what we're seeing and is certainly a legitimate concern, particularly as we are looking to transition a number of people from the fee-for-service population into the CCOs. I think that some of the people that are getting care within the fee-for-service system have gotten care from some providers who, quite frankly, never had contracts and relationships with the old managed care system.
Yeah.
And we, as is clear in statute, and what we've been all talking about, is that CCOs are not going to be able to discriminate based on a provider class. There also isn't any willing provider where they have to contract with absolutely everybody. We have some rules that are coming out. There's a process around if there are complaints and issues around that, we're going to have a clear process for dealing with that. And I guess my last comment about that would be, I think it gets back to the fact that we have some CCOs that have only been in existence for 13 days. And I've been trying to give, I think, everybody a little bit of time. There's been an incredible amount of work that's gone on by CCOs, by the state, by everybody, in getting boards, governance, new corporate structures, information systems, putting just current mental health and physical health panels together. And I'm not trying to downplay this as an issue or the importance of it, but I do think we have to put it into a little bit of the perspective of what the huge change that's gone on in communities over the last 6 months. So I'll put you this way. I hope to be able to come back in December, and I doubt that we're ever going to be in a place where everybody's happy, because that's my sense about these issues, but that we'll be in a much better place than we are today.
One of my concerns in this area, and you and I have talked about this before, is rural medical delivery, and rural now is pretty much anything 10 miles off I-5. We have a huge crunch coming, and I've been looking at some specific practice numbers, and one of my concerns about moving away from the capitation system that we've been using is that we have situations, hard copy situations I've looked at, where we have covered lives of 2,500, 3,000 assigned to a practice, but they're only seeing 1,100, 1,200 of those. And that's the way the system works.
Right.
But as we move toward medical homes, we're going to be seeing all 3,000 of them if the system is going to actually provide preventative care. And we have a huge void. I'm just very concerned that we're not casting the net wide enough to get providers lined up to do that. Otherwise, we're just going to ration health care, as you alluded to a minute ago.
Representative Thompson, I agree with you that dealing with the certainly the primary care workforce issue is going to be a concern for the CCOs and for us. And I think it is going to involve bringing more and different kinds of providers into the system, community health workers and others. I always talk about an example of a young child who was going to the doctor in the hospital multiple times because of asthma attacks. And when a community health worker went out to the house and helped them get rid of the kinds of things that cause asthma, lo and behold, there were less office visits. And so I think that there's a way to deal with that. And that's quite frankly what we're asking our CCOs, now that they're up and going and can start to work on. And hopefully we'll see a very different workforce and a primary care medical home that isn't just simply about more family doctors like me, but it's about social workers, community health workers, and an array of people to meet those needs.
Senator Bates.
Just three or four quick questions, so we could. Bruce, thanks for being here today. And number one, thanks for pulling us off over 6 months. This thing could have crashed easily. I don't think people necessarily understand the risk that we're taking.
You would have heard about it if it did.
Well, I mean, the MMI system is an example of crashed. This whole thing would have blown up. And so kudos for getting this done and for your people and the job you did. It's just actually amazing. A couple quick questions, though, just for the record. What's happening, I think, here is we're going to be developing what I call a punch list. We've built a big house now. We're starting to live in it. Yeah. We're finding things that the doors that don't close and things that don't work and outlets that aren't functioning. We're going to develop a punch list over the next 5 or 6 months of things that need to be fixed, and I think you'll be hearing about those as they go along. Biggest punch list right now being the dental program, which you've already talked about. Just for the record, first question, Senate Bill 201, I assume that applies to CCOs. I want to get on the record that it does.
Co-Chair Senator Bates, the issue that we worked a long time with Senate Bill 201, and it really is a bill that deals with the fact that when people transition between when it was managed care organizations, now CCOs, the primary concern is going to be patient continuity. And indeed, we're putting forth policies that are in line with Senate Bill 201 for how we deal with transitions. Patient continuity, when you have a two CCOs and a group of doctors that move from one to another. That's exactly what we plan to do.
Thank you. Follow-up questions along the same area. Assignment issues. DHS workers is a shared service between you and DHS. They're going to be a little confused, I think, in some areas of your primary is here, you've got a specialist over here, they're in one CCO and not in the other CCO. I would like to have a conversation with you and DHS that the caseworkers, who often make some pretty difficult decisions, really know where the primary is, the primary provider is, where the secondary provider is, and try to match up that primary as much as they can so the assignments occur appropriately. We've had trouble in the past with that before, and it's going to be a little confusing, I think, at first, and especially when we expand the population. Comment?
Before you comment, I just want to, there is an overflow available in Gallery West for those who aren't seating.
This really is in line with continuity of care and promoting that. And we're working on the kinds of ways we can get better information to both caseworkers and to members to make that choice. When members come onto the health plan, if there are areas where there are two CCOs, and we've got two parts of the state right now where there are, in Southern Oregon, as you know, in your area, and in Portland, individuals get an opportunity to choose a plan, a CCO. If they don't choose one, and about half the people choose one, they're then assigned, but the assignment, we have an algorithm we go through. If a family member is on one plan, we assign them to that plan, and we sort of whittle through a variety of decision points. But I think the issue is, how can we be certain that on the front end that OHP members have real good information about which doctors are in which plan, et cetera. One of the things we're looking at with the modernization on the DHS side of the information system and enrollment system is to be able to have that as a function on that system sometime in 2014. And I think that there are some ways that we're going to work with CCOs in the interim to get some information about panels to caseworkers as well. Important issue.
Thank you. Last question. Metrics. You just said November 5th. I was kind of taken aback by that. I didn't realize it was coming that quickly. As you said earlier, these plans are just getting started. We don't want to burden them with expensive performance improvement plans or metrics, but yeah, we do need to get those metrics. Many of them are just struggling with getting the structure set up, forming the relationships with hospitals and providers and dental groups and mental health groups and county commissioners. And, oh, by the way, we want new metrics for you, too. We do need those metrics. I'm surprised I assume it was November 5th of this year, not next year.
Yes.
My question is, number one, how hard are the feds pushing on this? Give us a little breathing room here. And number two, let's not make these PIPs so expensive that it starts sinking plans. We need to give them a little chance to adjust to them, make sure the metrics I would think are fairly broad. Data they can collect quickly and easily, and then start looking and seeing what can we do to improve the health of the populations they're serving, but not bear down any harder than we have to. And I'm afraid the feds are going to want to do that pretty soon. They've got a big investment here, but Lordy, 14 days, 44 days, and by November 5th, we want your metrics in place. Can we get some breathing room here?
Senator Bates, this is one area where our federal partners have taken a very, very strong and hard line. And, you know, their concern has been that we really do demonstrate accountability. And it's what we've wanted to do as well. We got them to move from July 5th to November 5th. We got an extra 120 days, if that gives you any sense about this. But having said that, so I don't think we're going to get any leeway in the timelines. It's actually written. We've committed to getting these done. We've been working on these with plans for the last 6 months. We had a transitional metric group that worked all spring. I think that the group is working to have the right balance between accountability and making certain that this doesn't provide, isn't overly burdensome. And if you look at we'll get all members of the committee the metrics list, and if you can look at the measures and why they were selected, I mean, some of them are selected primarily because we have the data, it's readily available. There isn't an additional burden in collecting it. And so I think we're trying to balance exactly what you wanted to do. It's one of the areas that it's going to be a lot of work. And I don't want to underestimate that. I don't want to underestimate that the timelines are short. That's quite frankly been this entire project has been. We've been moving from an aggressive timeline to aggressive timeline. We've all been rolling up our sleeves and meeting them. I'm fairly confident we can do that, but we're doing our best to balance things out.
Just a quick follow-up to that. If you conclude with those metrics, what you think the benchmark should be,
yeah,
and what the CCO's comments about the benchmarks and the metrics are, would be really helpful.
Okay.
Because otherwise, we're all going to get phone calls, you know.
We are getting phone calls.
After it's released, we all get phone calls. So just put that in up front, would help us out.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So in my community, I've got a lot of folks. Did I miss one? Sorry, I've got a lot of folks who do in-home care, assisted living, senior-type facilities. They have real concerns about how what their role is and where they intersect, and I don't have a clear answer for them. So hoping you give me that. And the other thing is one of my constituents wanted to communicate that they have apparently some meeting next month of all of these folks who do in-home health care-type stuff, and are you guys going to be able to send somebody to an event like that to put those folks' minds at ease, because they are, I'm getting calls, but I don't have, like I said, don't have a clear answer. And if you've got some thoughts around how this is all going to work for them.
Sure. Rep. Parrish, one, if you get me the date, time, and place, we'll have someone there, absolutely. But I think the first part of the question will hopefully shed a little bit of light on this. As you know, we have individuals who are in the long-term care system, getting their long-term care at home, being able to stay in home, and that system is staying the same right now. Those long-term community, those home health workers are still providing services through their local area agency on aging or through the state SPD, and that's staying intact. And in what we have done, and I think will be some comfort to some folks, is one, I think the first thing you can tell them is that there's been no changes to the long-term care system, so no worries there. But more importantly, we've required all of the CCOs to have a memorandum of understanding with the local area agencies on aging or senior organizations so that they can begin to better coordinate the in-home care with some of the medical care that people are getting through the Oregon Health Plan. So what we're looking to do is actually build some bridges and actually improve the coordination of care and ability, for instance, for that in-home care worker to know who the CCO is and who might be an appropriate contact within the CCO to get certain medical services for someone who's at home. So I think we're building the network to actually strengthen the community-based care system. And the short answer right now for those who are providing services within the long-term care system is that it hasn't changed.
Thanks. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. Bruce, a follow-up on the metrics thing. There's two uses of metrics, and the one is a long set of metrics that can be used for pay-for-performance kinds of things and to get information. But certain of those metrics ought to be fail-safes. And I wonder if we're saying these three, if you fail any one of them, your contract is in suspension or something. Are you differentiating the metrics on those kinds of ways? I mean, there are some things they absolutely need to be held responsible for.
Chair Greenlee, that's what the metrics group is really working on right now, is not... They've already adopted a set of metrics. It's actually a set of metrics that this transitional work group put together.
It's a long set, right?
It's about about 25 or so, 30, that deal with access and a variety of things. But what they're dealing with now is how to apportion that, how to create the appropriate incentive. And I think get at the point that you're talking about is not all of them are created equal, and that's what they're working on. I don't know that they'll get to there are three fail-safe ones, but I think it's that proportionality.
If somebody sees 30% of the population rather than 80% of the population a year, you want to do something about that. I mean, and there are two or three things that are
correct.
And this question is a little broader, Bruce. You, on our behalf, committed us to reducing the rate of medical inflation by 2 points. And that assumes something's going to be different in these CCOs, that we are going to create primary care homes. We are going to find a way to get prevention integrated with the care. We are going to develop chronic disease management systems. We are going to move people out. My impression is that, and it shouldn't be a surprise, is that the CCOs now are sort of business as usual. What happened last week is now happening this week under a different contractual arrangement. What sense do you have that we're going to really create new forms of care delivery inside these CCOs in time to affect the cost curve? To bend that cost curve. You and I know the culture of the healthcare system is a very rich and powerful culture. And
yes.
Both visualizing new ways of doing it and then moving towards those new ways is not an easy process. What hope do you have that the medical care system, when you come back next September to talk to us, will be dramatically different, and we can say now we're on our way to bending the cost curve? Mm-hmm.
Chair Greenlee, as you know, I'm a glass half full kind of guy, and I actually am very optimistic, and I'll tell you why. It's actually optimism based on some information. One, as background, when we've made this commitment, we've understood that it's going to take several years. In the first year, there is no lowering of the cost trend. In the second year, we're committing to 1%.
Okay.
And it's by the end of the second year that we get to 2%. So we have some time. Number two, I think what is different and what really makes me optimistic are three things. One, as part of what we're working with the CCOs is they actually have to submit a transformation plan. Nothing happens unless you plan for it, and the CCOs have to, as part of their contract, and one of the things we've worked on is submit to us by January 1 a plan for exactly doing what you described. How are they going to change the care model, change payment, do things that will lay that out, and we're going to work with them to do that. Number two, I think as many of you know, part of this legislation was setting up innovator agents. And these are individuals that are going to work with the plans to be able to share best practices. We plan on creating a transformation center where we can bring in experts to help local communities do a variety of things that they're looking to do. And the third thing that makes me optimistic about this is that I'm seeing it happen already. And that I'm seeing parts of the state and communities where I was down in Grants Pass, and they're having a conversation about how they can train community health workers to become part of their network. I'm talking to many, many communities about the whole notion of primary care homes. I had a conversation just yesterday with the medical director for a consortium out in Eastern Oregon about some ideas about improving, making more robust primary care homes in Eastern Oregon, very much appropriate to Representative Thompson's comment about one or two primary care docs in 10,000 people. So I'm seeing that happen already. I think that our CCOs know that this is what needs to happen. It's going to be the only way. And quite frankly, and this is my maybe I'm more than optimistic, I see a lot of the providers in communities understanding that we've got to start to look at ways to change how we do things, or we're not going to sustain ourselves. So I'm optimistic.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bruce, has the Oregon Health Authority set a goal for when the CCO boards will be meeting fully in open meetings?
Co-chairs, Senator Shields, we've set certainly a goal that they've had to have boards up and operational to be a CCO. I don't know if we've provided a time frame around when they meet. And in terms of public meeting, we are not requiring that the boards meet publicly. These CCOs are not public bodies. I mean, they take a variety of corporate forms. I think, as you know, some are not-for-profit organizations. Some actually are for-profit organizations. And I don't believe we have any requirement for them to meet publicly. I do believe we have a requirement that they have a community advisory board that does meet publicly, and that a representative from that community advisory board has to actually be on the board of directors. But I'll look at some of the specifics about that and get back to you.
Okay. Follow up, Madam Chair. I think one of the things that we're seeing in our community is that because the board is making major decisions behind closed doors, there is concern about how they're making the decisions, what process they're using. Are they receiving testimony from the public? And I think that's something we might want to think about going into the next session. This is billions of dollars in state money. And I think the worst place we could be is essentially with an unregulated monopoly without them operating in the light of day.
And Senator Shields, I philosophically very much agree with the fact that the success of our ability to change our healthcare system is going to really be based on transparency of information and in putting together the kinds of community processes that work. How that happens and how we regulate that, I think, is going to be a lot of discussion. I think that regardless of what we require or don't, I do believe that this model is based on a community participatory model, and that if that's not happening, my guess is people won't be successful. But that's, I think, part of what we're going to learn as time goes forward.
Representative Conger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two quick questions and then a comment. The first is, could you elaborate a little bit, Bruce, on the innovator agents? And specifically what I'm asking about is in SB 1580, the use or interaction with innovator agents was driven by a request from the CCO. So it was sort of voluntary and actually in response to demand or need. And I have heard, although I don't know that this is true, that it's now mandatory that the innovator agents work directly with the CCO because of something in the Medicaid waiver.
Representative Conger, members of the committee, the bill did set out innovator agents. The CMS has actually asked us to be sure that every CCO have an innovator agent. I think what we need to do is, what we're trying to do is work collaboratively with CCOs to talk about how they want that to happen. What CMS didn't specify is where they sit, how, whether it's full-time, part-time, et cetera. So I think we have some leeway to be able to be certain that we can, I think, enter into the innovator agent relationship between the state and the CCO in a collaborative manner, and we're seeking to do that. So I'm optimistic we can work through that. We're actually having some of the discussions about that right now around some of the contract amendments and having some back and forth on some of that language. And I think that we can, the point is not to be burdensome. It's been to be helpful, and it hasn't been meant to provide an extra layer of bureaucracy. It's been meant to actually cut through that. And I think we can get to that.
Thank you. Just a quick point on that. I think that it actually relates to Senator Shields' comment and the broader comment about the cap on funding, which is that we have created a lot of new burden on the agency, I think, also on the CCOs, and maybe by proxy or indirectly on providers.
Yeah.
But there is no additional money. And so I see a problem potentially developing between our expectations about transformation, which actually involves the application of resources and planning and some of the things we've been talking about, and availability of resources to actually do that. So that's sort of a side note, but on the innovator agent subject specifically, if a CCO didn't want one to help them, it would be great to get back to something that is voluntary, or identifying an innovator agent within their cost structure, within the CCO's cost structure, so that it's not consuming additional resources. So I hope you'll look at that. My second question was, could you just briefly talk about non-managed care plan participants? And because I understand that within areas that are covered by managed care, there are also people who are on a fee-for-service plan under OHP. So they must be a different population pool. I don't know any details about that, and I don't know that we need to know it. But are they also being moved into the CCOs now?
Representative Conger, the short answer to your second question is yes, they will be moved in November 1. We'll be transitioning them in. Again, apropos of the dental care discussion, we've been trying to stage when we sort of add new layers in so that we can all deal with this effectively. Right now, we're actually negotiating the terms and rates of that with the CCOs, and we've had a lot of back and forth on the data, how we're going to pay CCOs for this population, share risk. Some of them are in fee for service because they have extraordinarily rare or costly medical problems, and we're trying to do this in a way that promotes good coordination but doesn't put anybody at undue financial risk. So that'll happen November 1. We're working on the contracts right now. Your first question, I just want to be certain to be clear about the innovator agents are not paid for by the CCO. They're actually paid for by us. And you're correct Just like CCO is not getting any additional funds, neither did the agency to hire these. And I think what we're trying to do is what I believe and I hope that CCOs are trying to do, is that we're going to be, there are places that we're going to become more efficient and be able to reduce costs and expenses elsewhere in some of the things that we were doing that maybe we don't need to do anymore that didn't bring value. And then we're going to shift some of those to new and different things that hopefully will save additional money. You know, that's how we plan to hopefully fund the innovator agents, is if they're going to indeed reduce some of our bureaucracy, we're going to transition to that so that we end up staying at, you know, a net, certainly for this next year, cost neutral. And it's going to be, I think, difficult for all of us. I'm not in any way underestimating that. I do understand the burdens, and it's something we're all working through.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a quick comment about the sort of the disconnect between the expectations and the speed and everything. I just want to say, kind of echo the comments earlier about, I think we have actually shown tremendous progress in a short period of time with a complex set of reforms. Obviously, all of the results aren't in yet, and there's a reason for that. It's because, as you've said, you have to take it step by step. And there are first things first. You know, it's like building a house. You have to have the foundation, which is probably governance and the formation of CCOs. And our hope is that there will be windows and doors someday in the house. There is a timing question there, and it all comes down to money, ultimately, as well as better care and healthcare transformation. And the missing piece in my mind, and I know we've talked about this before, but I'm going to keep repeating it, is the engagement of the person receiving the healthcare services, the patient, the OHP plan member, in transforming their health. And we don't seem to have any connection. We, you know, we're completely focused on the payer and the provider side. The third leg of the stool doesn't even exist. And so this comment is aimed at understanding that there are the first steps, the pieces that have to be put in place. I'm hoping that you're thinking about working on that, you know, building that third leg of the stool. And if you haven't yet, would certainly like to discuss that with you and figure out if there's something we can do.
Rep. Conger, in keeping with Senator Bates's analogy of the punch list and yours of the House, as you and I have discussed, I agree this is a room we've got to build, and it's on the punch list. It's yet to get punched, I think, for the reasons you've outlined. We've been doing a tremendous amount of work, but I think that's part of the transformation. And one of the things we quite frankly hope we can engage with some of the CCOs in is that some of their transformation plans will have some ideas about some of this. And I think it's hugely important.
Representative Kennedy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Co-Chair Thompson kind of already alluded to my issue, but I appreciate your comment about soon we can expect a clear process, I assume a good one, on dealing with CCO provider panel discrimination. I think having a full array of services, people have a lot of different expectations when it comes to their medical care, and I think we need to be prepared to meet that.
I would agree.
Okay, this conversation obviously is not finished. We will continue it in December, but we do need to move on. So thank you, Dr. Goldberg, very much.
I know you made it quite well without your sidekick up there.
Was he making faces behind my back?
Bruce, hang on just a second. I'm sorry, I had to step out for a minute, if I could, Madam Chair.
Yeah, we need to move quickly.
Okay. Just a concern, wondering, this is really out of the box, but when Congress raised the debt ceiling, they put an absolute mark in time, January 2nd, where if they didn't do budgetary things, that there was going to be 12% across the board cuts. my faith in Congress being able to do anything between now and January is relatively bleak. Are you considering those factors as you're moving forward? Because 12% is 12%, and it would be everywhere.
As you know, Senator Cruz, Medicaid's a state and a federal partnership, and we often need to change course based on federal difference in federal direction. What I would say is my experience and my ability to predict what Congress will do is probably no better than yours, so we've taken a wait-and-see attitude. Quite frankly.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's just, you know, my faith in Congress being able to act is rather weak, and that is an absolute date certain, so.
Thank you. With that, I'd like to call up Bud Pierce, Gwen Dayton, and Richard Lane with a quick update on the Patient Safety and Defensive Medicine Work Group.
Quick.
I've seen these people before.
Okay, good morning. I'm Dr. Bud Pierce. I'm the president of the Oregon Medical Association, and I'm a practitioner in hematology oncology here in Salem, Oregon. And first of all, one quick aside, my dad was a janitor, my mom's an immigrant, and it's special to be able to be up here and talk like this, so I do appreciate that, and I appreciate you listening to me. The Institute of Medicine came out in the last week or so with another report. That's our leading think tank of medical leaders and economists discussing how out of our $2.8 trillion healthcare bill a year, about $750 billion are completely wasted. It means about $7.5 billion in Oregon. That's yearly. That's not for 10 years. And so that's something to think about as we think about medical liability and changes in healthcare delivery system. But to today's point, 13 years ago, they came out with a report on the safety of patients in hospitals, reported that between 44,000 and 98,000 patients died each year in American hospitals from preventable medical errors. And that set the hospitals off on an agenda to try to improve that system. And it's been difficult. It's been very difficult. We have too many deaths and injuries due to preventable medical errors. So I'm a practitioner. I'm a trench guy. I occasionally leave the practice of medicine to get involved in this kind of event and situation. And so I've been at it for about 25 years. Started medical school 35 years ago. I worked from 6 to 7 yesterday. I saw patients this morning. I've probably seen 150 to 200,000 patient encounters in my career. And I can tell you that errors are not accepted in our culture. They're not discussed. They tend to be suppressed. It's hard to whistleblow on yourself. It's a very difficult thing. And then we have the liability system. The liability system currently has a major part of our medical malpractice and our error solving. And that system tends to be a system in which you're told to not talk about things. You're not really transparent. You need to have attorneys around if you discuss a situation. And even in peer review, it has almost a feeling of a little bit of a mini trial. And it's really hard to bring out information. And I am convinced in my decades of practice that if we're going to really make headway, we need to open this up, we need to air it out, we need to talk about it, we have to identify our problems, we need to solve them. And that's going to make the care of our patients better and make our profession better. So the governor has come forward with a proposal that has been before the House of Medicine, backed by the Oregon Medical Association. And to simplify it, it's an early discussion and resolution process and a mediation process, and then a trial can still occur if it cannot be resolved. So we're not taking on the issue of our legal system. We're trying to modify that. We've tried that in the past. It was unsuccessful. I don't believe our society wants us to go in that direction right now. So we imagine what would happen is if there's a major adverse event, that this would be reported to the Oregon Safety Agency, Patient Safety Agency, and that the patient would be informed that a major adverse event had occurred for the family, and that it was being investigated. And then the provider care facility would investigate, try to figure out what happened, and then report back to the family, the individual. And also, the report would go to the patient safety agency. At that point in time, the issue may be, that may be it. Just an explanation can many times solve a difficult problem, and families are just happy to know that they were told that something went wrong. They understand that medicine is not perfect, people are not perfect, and that may solve it. But sometimes monies have to change hands, and we envision whoever's involved in payment would come together and make an honest, solid offer for the injury that occurred, not a lowball offer, not trying to take advantage of anyone, and that then the person who the offer is made to would have legal representation, and hopefully that would end it. The beauty of that system would be that the cost, the overhead cost, could be far less, because we spend so much money deposing and arguing and getting to that point in time. If that wouldn't solve it, we could go to mediation, and if mediation didn't solve it, people could still file. It works the other way also. So someone is upset a year and a half after an event. They can't serve me as a practitioner. They have to go through the same process. It gives us a chance to talk about it, air it out, before we have to go to trial. You know, a trial to me is analogous to emergency room medicine. It's the most expensive. So if we can keep the solution out of the courtroom, we can save a lot of money and we can compensate people. I'm going to finish up with talking about where this has been tried. Probably the best place is the University of Michigan. In 2001, the University of Michigan began this program. They do it through University Hospital and their affiliates. That year, they had about 2,000 adverse reports into their system. And they had, that year, they had around 50 cases that they had to make payments on. That was the first year they started. By 2011, they now have 20,000 reports into the system. The volumes have doubled, so the reporting has gone up 5 times. That means that people who are in the system trust it, it's reliable, and it seems to be working for them. The amount of money the number of claims have gone from that 50 to actually 30, but if you think about doubling the volume of cases, it really went from 100 to 30. So payouts per year have gone from 100 to 30 in this open system of discussion and attempts to resolve it. The amount of payment per claim has gone from about low $400,000 to closer to $200,000 per claim. You can imagine it's a more efficient system. You don't have to spend as much money on the overhead. And if you look at the OBs, who are certainly at risk, high risk of lawsuit in that system, their premiums of working within that system are half of the premiums paid by OBs outside the system. And the OBs in that system have no upward cap. In other words, they're not capped at $5 million, $10 million, or $20 million. So there's reliability in the malpractice payout component of the system. We've also spoken to the past president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. Massachusetts has passed legislation to put this into place. They have a demonstration project, but he described that as they have money from the federal government to do this. That's why they call it that. They really are rolling this out and implementing it, and they studied this for 5 years to do what we want to do here in Oregon, and that's an emergency room doctor. So they're at risk of liability. This has been done in the VA system. This has been done at Stanford. This is done by a lot of our hospital systems who try to do early discussion and resolution before it goes to court. They've been doing it. This is done in Roseburg Hospital. So Kaiser does it. So it's there. And the question is, would it benefit our state to create a codified system, to put this into place, to make it the expectation, and that we would get better reporting of adverse events, we'd have a lower overhead cost, we'd have a more satisfied public, and it would be good for the profession. For us to be able to air out our problems in a way that's protected and safe, resolve them, improve systems, and move on is where we need to go. And that's why we back this proposal, and that's all I have to say.
Any comments from
Chairman?
Yeah.
I was Vice President of Research at Kaiser when they put in the an arbitration process in the middle. It wasn't exactly this process. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing was that the overall cost went up. Mm-hmm. But Kaiser thought that was great, because what made the cost go up is there were people getting sort of their just due that otherwise would not have gone into the system. So, I mean, the other important thing about what you're talking about, however it ends up, is I think it serves more people because they get an opportunity to get into a system that they might not have to get into if they have to hire a lawyer and all these other elements.
There's an important Harvard study from 1991, relation between malpractice claims and adverse events due to negligence, and they reviewed 30,000 charts and identified 280 cases of injury and negligence, and 8 were identified by the liability system. And actually about 50 were filed, so the 42 of them were viewed by medical people as not, but out of the 280, 8 were identified.
Yeah, that's
exactly
the point. It's a very important
point. That's an important point.
Mm-hmm. Representative Conger.
Madam Chair, are Gwen and Richard going to testify as well, or are you going to release the panel?
No.
I think they're just
okay. They're just there for moral support. Just very quickly, I wanted to say it was a pleasure to serve on the work group with you, Dr. Pearson. Your
Thanks.
Able leadership, we were able to cover a lot of ground in a short period of time. And Gwen and Richard, I want to say appreciate very much your professionalism and the problem solving approach that you all brought to that work group. So thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, what committee members, what you have, this draft legislation is what was presented at LC yesterday. It's a very unfinished product at this point in time. It's being drafted basically by Representatives Conger, Garrett, myself, and Senator Pozanski. We're going to be the sponsors. It's being drafted in both chambers, just as a fail-safe. We have also told Ledge Council, and Marissa's going to be the drafter, that we waive all confidentiality, so it's open to anybody, because it needs to be. We will be having further meetings. As the first thing LC is going to do is clean up your work. but there's a lot of points that need to be refined. I'm still not comfortable with, for example, putting the cons. We need a new relating clause, and we will get that. Because serious events is not something I think we need a better term of art in that area. So we'll be looking at that. The issues relative to the Patient Safety Commission and how we mesh all that together. We need to be very, very clear that we aren't damaging the mission that currently exists by adding this new mission to that organization. It's going to take us a while probably to get there, but with cooperation of the Legislative Assembly and the Governor's Office and these fine people here, I have every confidence we will get there, and I think this is going to be a fine product. But I just wanted people to know it's in LC now. We've done that. We said we would. And you all will be getting contact probably through the Governor's Office. Mike, we said you'd be first contact for the Governor's work group. Just so we have direct lines, and I'm expecting we'll probably all be getting back together within a couple weeks to see what issues they have brought up down in LC that we need to address. So
we need to move quickly, yeah. Senator Bates.
Just a couple of quick comments and a question or two. First, thanks everybody for the work you've done. I obviously was not a subcommittee because I'm one of the guys in the trenches and probably carry a little prejudice into the argument. So separate me out from is probably a wise thing to do. I'm also, though, in the trenches and used to be chief of medicine in two different hospitals. And how we used to handle what we called sentinel events in those days was we would resolve the sentinel event and we never told anybody about it. And we're not allowed to tell anybody about it. We actually had gag rules on us because we didn't want to generate lawsuits. Mm-hmm. Obviously not the good way to go. There's two issues here as far as I'm concerned, and I think you're trying to address both of them. I want to hear a little bit about both of them a little more. The cost of litigation, the cost of these systems is less than 1% of the healthcare dollar. It's really insignificant. And frankly, whether physicians like to admit it or not, it's built into our rates for what we're paid. It's what we pay for malpractice insurance. So if that can be lowered, great, but it's not the real factor here. The real factor here is patient safety and sharing information you learn from these things with other physicians in a way that physicians feel comfortable in hearing that information. And that's going to be really, really tricky. That is really difficult to do because everyone talks in the aisles about what's going on and in the back rooms about what's going on in the case, and then everyone gets shamed and nobody talks about it. So how you manage to pull that off through the safety committee is going to be really important. I think you have to be shielded from the point of view of who actually did what to who, but the information's got to get out to everybody so that we all learn from that and those mistakes aren't repeated. Good luck. Okay, that needs to be done. I'd like to hear your comments on that. Second piece is defensive medicine, which is a huge cost to our system, and frankly, at times, is not only not beneficial to patients, but hurts patients. And I haven't heard you comment on that either. Some of the imaging we do is actually dangerous to patients, and we need a system that says we're not going to be doing too many CAT scans anymore, we're not going to be doing other things anymore because of defensive medicine that actually hurts our patients. And that's also a tough one to deal with. I'd like to hear how you're thinking about dealing with that in this system. Both those things need to be addressed, and if we don't address those, we really haven't gotten very far. You're going to hear a lot of comments about this. Is this another way for trial attorneys to find out more information about a case and run up to a bigger lawsuit? I don't think that's the case in this. I think you've really got a system that will work if it's done properly and actually will make it a better system for patients and doctors. I think a physician facing the possibility of going to court and sitting in front of a judge and a jury versus going into a system like this, having a chance to explain and discuss it, might start changing the culture of medicine over the next 10, 15 years, that we're not so defensive in what we do, a little more open about what we do, and we admit our mistake. Not negligence, but mistakes because we're human. So comments on those two areas would be most important to me, and trying to blend those into the legislation would be really important too.
Thanks, Dr. Senator Bates. It's a cultural issue, and I think it would really start, frankly, at the medical school and our DO school and our PA schools. And I think we have to get the word out and expect our medical teachers that if they teach the physicians of tomorrow and PAs of tomorrow, this is how it is, and we need to talk about it. We need to open it up there at the training institutions. We had to do a mandatory CME for pain. I would say this is probably a more important mandatory CME if we could figure out how to do it in a way that, again, is encouraging, educational, and again, really try to engage physician leadership and possibly through our CCO mechanism. I always think that this is going to be a great way to convince people that there's a structure around them, that this has really changed, and that this is where we want to go. We need to go as a profession, and it's for our good. And I think we could build enough momentum by going at it in that way, by educating, using our medical schools, and really our CCO mechanism. And hopefully, again, through our publications, and if we make it work, and the word is positive, people want to talk about this, as you know. We don't want to bury things that go bad, and it's a huge burden to carry. The defensive medicine, you know, that question was brought forward to the Michigan people. They haven't had success on that yet. I just wonder, again, if we can get comfortable with the idea that the judgment is okay, errors in judgment may or may not occur, but again, you're working in a safe system that you're not going to be penalized or punished if you don't order a test. I almost think that we have to create the system before people get the comfort, and I don't know if we can really get there other than putting in algorithms of care that just say you're safe, but that could be helpful, but I think that's a little bit tricky. So I think it's really cultural. I think we need to We need to bend the cost curve, we need to rethink this. And again, keep our eye on the patient. The purpose of medicine is the patient. The number one goal we have is patients need to be safe. Second one is to try to cure them. Third one is relieve pain and suffering. We got to hear that. We got to bring that to our profession. We have to do that. We've gotten so technical where we love our science, and science is clean and nice and all that. But we need to change our way of thinking.
Well, I hate to cut this off, but I know we're going to have a lot of discussion on this in the 2013 session. With that, do you have any comments?
Co-chair Lona Sanderson, Greenwood Gunn, Dayton from the OMA. And no, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, and we look forward to being here again.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Richard Lane, appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I just agree with my colleagues that have been working on this, and appreciate the work of Senator Cruz and Representative Conger, Senator Brzezinski, and Representative Garrett in the 1580 work group.
Well, it's refreshing to see all three of you working together on this very, very difficult issue that we haven't been able to do much with in the past.
Can I just ask, is there general consensus on the task force of what's going forward?
Yes. Complete.
Yes.
Excellent. Consensus.
Yes.
With that, thank you very much, and I'd like to switch gears on development of Citizen Advisory Council. Janet Bauer, Betty Johnson, please come forward quickly.
This is the fail safe, because you need to know better what I am. So I want this by some time in December.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and I am very much appreciative of your invitation to us today. I am a member of a new ad hoc group called CCL Watch. It's a consumer advocacy group whose aim is to support successful healthcare transformation implementation. Our activities have focused on administrative rulemaking and CCOs to date, and CCO Community Advisory Committee, I'm here to talk, share with you information about what we have found about how the advisory committees are going. We believe that a well-informed and independent advisory council can provide important direction and feedback to CCO leaders who are endeavoring to create a patient-centered system. We also know that such an advisory council won't happen by accident, and sort of hence our interest in monitoring and finding out how it was going and what we could do to encourage strong advisory councils. So one of the first things we did was we developed recommendations for CCOs on how they might build a strong and useful advisory council, and that has been a tool that advocates in our group have used in talking with CCOs to the extent that they've been able to make those connections, and I assume that you have copies of that. So recently we've sort of done a reassessment about where CCOs have been and have reached out to them and found them to be in very different places in terms of a number of ways in terms of setting up their advisory councils. We found some to be very transparent about their activities and have reached out to our group for input. Application materials and their policies have been easy to find. Staff is accessible. And in other CCOs, we haven't had that that experience so much. In fact, some of our group members have been working to recruit some of their colleagues in CCO regions in the state to these councils, and in some cases have come up with frustration about even finding who to contact and talk about it, and have had trouble finding information about the recruitment and application process. So in a summary of where we stand, not all CCOs have operational websites for us to find who to contact. 11 of the 14 CCOs operating today have a website of some sort, either an independent one or a page on one of their partners' sites. And less than half of them mention advisory councils. Less than half have a posted application. So this has meant a bit of digging for us in trying to dig in and find who can tell us about their process. We have been able to determine that five CCOs have seated advisory councils, and three others have formed provisional committees of consumers and others to help with in the formation stage. We are not so concerned about the fact that not all CCOs have formed an advisory council as we are about public access to information about the process. To their credit, some CCOs are being very deliberate and thoughtful about forming their councils and are taking some time to do it. For instance, there are some who have chosen to form councils in every county that they serve simply because their regions are so big and diverse. Some of the things that we are watching for are things like, does the application process, is it accessible to people with physical and mental health special needs? Are any background checks done in a way to avoid discouraging individuals who have criminal records associated with behavioral or health conditions from applying, since some of those individuals are the very individuals that we need to be hearing from in terms of building a good system? How independent is the council? Can the council choose its own officers after initial appointments? And can they be dismissed with no reason by the board? We have found that some cannot appoint their own leaders and can be dismissed without reason. We have, this has raised some concern about how independently those bodies will function. Additionally, is there staff support? Are there other kinds of support to council members? It's our belief that particularly the OHP participants on the council may need to have support in leadership development and understanding their role. They don't come to those bodies with the support of an employer, for instance, who is sponsoring them to be there. And so they're on their own. We are concerned that support is, there's enough structure provided to help those individuals be effective and succeed and really are able to contribute in the way that they need to for the effort to be successful. So in sum, we think that support is critical, and it needs to come in part, at least, from outside of the CCO. We have contemplated the idea of the merits of sort of a statewide learning cohort of advisory council members so that they can learn from each other, so that they're not feeling isolated, so they can learn about their role and feel like it's something that they can continue to do and participate in a meaningful way. That concludes my comments, and I appreciate your invitation.
Brought up some very interesting points, and I'm so glad that we had the chance to hear you. Ms. Johnson, do you have any comments?
Yes, I wanted to speak with you also. My name is Betty Johnson. I'm the immediate past chair of Mid Valley Healthcare Advocates, and I live in Corvallis. I'm tempted to, you know, try to respond to a lot of your questions and comments about CCOs, but time doesn't permit that, so I'm going to try to really focus primarily on just some very specific things. In the area where I live, Intercommunity Health Network was one of the first 8 CCOs to be certified by the Oregon Health Authority, and they began their operation on the 1st of August. IUTN previously had a contract with OHA to provide physical health services for OHP members. Mid Valley Healthcare Advocates began its involvement with the IHN and the whole CCO process in the fall of 2011, when we initiated a series of community meetings. And our purpose was to really explain to the public, and hopefully OHP members who were in attendance, the whole idea of the transformation legislation. And later, at another series of meetings, we invited people who attended those community meetings to submit recommendations for the governing board membership and also for the community advisory council. The reason I'm telling you that context is that we had really good cooperation with IHN in the arrangements for those meetings, and they were very forthcoming in providing information. So IHN, you know, was one of those that you mentioned, Janet, that has gone on a very deliberate process. The CAC members have not been selected and appointed as of this point, but they will be very shortly now. But the first step that IHN took was to convene a representative community group under the leadership of the Health Department Administrator in Benton County to actually define a very carefully thought out process for the recruitment, selection, and structure for the Community Advisory Council, certainly being guided by the transformation legislation. That was, you know, a very deliberate thing, and it addresses many of the questions that Janet Bauer has mentioned previously, and I will enlarge on those. Rather than distribute the four-page document that this work group produced, I thought it might be helpful if you had...
Could you hand those out?
Helpful to look at this graphic, which Janet is going to give you. I'm relying on that saying, the validity of the saying about a picture is worth a thousand words, and we don't have time for that. I would like for you to know that the CAC group in each county will have the opportunity to address local concerns, the particular culture and the needs of people in each of the counties. Even though there's a long history of these three counties working together, there still are unique needs, and I think the at least our experience in working with the people in each of the counties planning those meetings that I mentioned earlier. Each county wants to be sure everybody understands what their particular unique needs are. So I'm very pleased that this work group came up with the idea of having these subgroups in each county, and they would feed into the overall regional 19-member group. So, first of all, I want to commend IHN for the extensive recruitment process. They sent an application to every one of the OHP members in the three-county area. In addition, we followed through, Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates followed through on those recommendations that were proposed in the meetings that we had in each county in March. We have contacted those people and reminded them that the deadline is this Friday, tomorrow, and also looking forward to the fact that the appointments will be completed by the 1st of October. A couple other things about how this has operated to date, how the groundwork has been laid and pieces put in place. In this document that the work group produced, there's a process and a structure which will, quote, empower consumers, reflect member and community demographics, draw on existing advisory groups. For example, the three health departments have advisory committees, and there are peer counselors and others that have been, the intent is to involve them, and they have, of course, been invited to participate. In terms of operational commitments, I think we, again, need to recognize IHN for their support in this area. They have agreed that the CAC meetings, Community Advisory Council meetings, will be held in various locations. They're not all going to be held in Corvallis or in Newport or in Albany. And certainly going to provide greater access for the public to keep informed. The community advisory councils will be supported by reimbursement for transportation and by various technology to facilitate that participation. I'm also very pleased about the fact that the three counties, together with IHN, have agreed to provide staff support for the Community Advisory Council, because they really recognize that the CAC responsibilities, particularly in relation to the needs assessment and the community health plan that the CAC is to develop, those responsibilities would be absolutely unmanageable if they didn't have some staff assistance. Another really important thing is that the document does assure the CAC members that they can elect their own officers, and that the chair of the CAC will be a member of the governing board. Advocates have recommended that the CAC follow the public meeting law. Senator Shields, that's one of your concerns and mine. And even though we don't know the outcome of that, we certainly are going to be monitoring to see how that goes, and we'll be encouraging open meetings and the opportunity for the public to ask questions. So in summary, I really am encouraged by the groundwork that has been laid, and the extensive recruitment, the well-defined plans for how this Community Advisory Council will be able to operate. And we look forward, not at our initiation, but the staff of the IHN have invited advocates to participate with them on a regular basis. Every quarter we will have a meeting so that we can communicate directly with the staff. And we will also, of course, be meeting regularly with the Community Advisory Council, because I really feel like that, going back to Representative Greenlick, your question about is there really going to be transformation or is it going to be business as usual, I think that the Community Advisory Councils are going to be key to that. And then the community supporting and encouraging the Community Advisory Councils to be empowered to do their job. So. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I mean, I think CCOs will be of extreme value, or the community, the citizen advisory council are going to be especially valuable to CCOs. So thank you so much. And we need to move on. We're really way behind. And so I'm sorry, colleagues, but we need to move on. But thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to eliminate the all-payer, all-claims database program. We just don't have time. We will be moving that to December. And we will have Capital Dental Care come quickly to talk about Deborah Loy. Deborah Loy, talk about your issues.
I don't want to apologize to Gretchen.
Well, we already talked to Gretchen. She was A-okay with it, so.
Thank you to the chairs and the committee members for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Deborah Loy. I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs from Capital Dental Care, a dental care organization with the Oregon Health Plan. Because of time, I'm going to be like one of your staff members who reads the floor bills and try to go through my testimony as quickly as possible to try to express some of the issues I was asked to testify on. My written testimony has been provided to the committees. When I was initially asked to testify, it was to share on our plan's experience trying to contract with three of the CCOs that were to go live on August 1st, two of which I have highlighted in my written testimony. Dr. Goldberg has expressed some of the DCO issues. My testimony will be to share my plan's experience and also my plan's concerns. We were prepared to go live with three of the CCOs on August 1st. The Oregon Health Authority made a determination not to allow DCOs and CCOs to contract. A task force was developed to work through contracting issues. I'm sure OHA and my peers got tired of us being the plan that kept saying, are we there yet? Can we go live? Are we scared spitless? Yes, we are. Change is not an easy thing to do, but we had hoped with these particular CCOs to develop best practices and innovations that could be carried forth to others as we moved into the future. And we were concerned that if you lose momentum, it's sort of hard to gain that back. On August 24th, the Oregon Health Authority did release a memo indicating that plans, CCO and DCO could contract and laying out a plan for that. However, that memo opened up some concerns and some issues that were unanticipated, one of which Dr. Goldberg has spoke to, which is the first dental plan to sort of contract with a CCO, in essence, gives that CCO dental allowance and sort of a ticket to do dental, which allows them to both, according to OHA's interpretation, to both contract with the dental care organizations and develop their own networks. That did not seem to be anticipated, I don't think. It also doesn't seem to fit the nature of a transitionary period of on or before July 1st, 2014 for all dental plans to be contracted with. I have expressed some of the concerns in my written testimony, so I won't read to all of them, but that one is a very big one. My plan is actually an open plan model, which means I can contract with any provider in a service area if they so want to. I pay fee for service, so a provider can elect to do just a few families, or they can elect to do more. So I have indicated to CCOs who we are interested in moving forward with, we want to grow capacity. Let's do that together, not let's do that in competition to one another. The other is the issue that Dr. Goldberg spoke to, which is on governance and where does a dental care or oral health fit into the CCO governance model. We are one of the managed care organizations listed as moving into the CCO model. Oral health is referenced as part of health. We had floor speeches from legislators that referenced oral health as a major component, but because the statute is silent on specifically addressing that, it's not been interpreted as that. So I really look forward to making that scary step to contract and continue to integrate oral health, but certainly look to the legislature to help clarify some of the issues and concerns that have arisen.
Thank you. Comments from the committee? Yes, Senator Bates.
Just real quick, a lot of us have been really involved in this DCO situation. First off, I want to thank the DCOs for the great work they've done over the last almost 15 years, and hope you'll continue to do. The basic issues I see here is DCOs are more regional than CCOs, and blending them back into the CCOs is going to be a challenge. That's one part. The second part being that I'm concerned that CCOs will try to start setting up their own dental plans, and we'll lose all the hard work that's been done in the organizations that have been set up for the last 15 years. But I really don't want that to happen. This is, again, part of the punch list. And, Madam Chair, I would expect that in December we'll be looking at this again. I would like to avoid a legislative fix to it. I'd like to see it done administratively. But if that's not the case, I think we'll have to do it legislatively, and I prefer not doing that. I think that the part of cost of health care that oral health generates has been underestimated by those of us in the other side of the equation. The amount of dental care that goes on in emergency rooms on weekends at night, the amount of sepsis from oral infections has not been tracked. We have no idea what that really looks like. I know that may be something a lot of you may not understand, but I can give you a couple of case histories of literally million-dollar cases resulting from dental infections that caused sepsis, which is an infection of the bloodstream, went to the heart, went to the kidneys, and ends up people having long-term dialysis for the rest of their lives, or valve replacements that cost $500,000. So it's been underestimated. It's something we need to deal with. We don't want to lose our DCOs. We want them to blend into the CCOs, and we'll be looking forward to see how well this happens between now and December.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Are you feeling pretty comfortable with the situation now?
No.
You're still pretty nervous.
Yeah.
We're still prepared to try to go live, especially with AllCare and Willamette Valley Community Health, who we actually are one of the founding members of, too. So that was a really big step for us to take as a dental plan. However, we really want to begin to work on the positive aspects of how oral health can be integrated and not be bogged down with some of this stuff that really, for all right, I wasn't anticipating. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much,
thank
Deborah.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Keep in touch.
All right. Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. Rocky King, Amy Fave.
Is that the same electronically, Amy?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is the one we
it
sent
is
you.
What you folks have electronically?
Yesterday.
Are we still changing?
No.
Yes.
Sandy, should we do it on here or just with the paper?
Whatever. It's quick and easy.
We'll just do it on the paper. It's quicker.
Good paper. Quicker. Get it going. Madam Chair, co-chairs, vice co-chairs. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation, and with me is...
I'm Amy Favre, deputy director of the Health Insurance Exchange Corporation.
So it's, a year before we implement the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, October 1, 2013, and so we're kind of at a different stage, I think, than any time that we've testified before you. It was a short 10 and a half months ago that our board was first established and we first started hiring staff. And it's really been about 8 months that we've had a chance to work on the corporation side. So we want to go through and give you, I know time's short, a quick update of where we are. And the first slide really looks at kind of some of the timelines that we've established for the next year. And one of the things you'll notice there is, first of all, in October, the first date... Did you want
to?
No, he was asking.
No, we were just going to do it by hand. Here.
Okay, I got you.
Okay.
The
first date of October 2012, which is next month, we really start the process. We release a request for application to carriers to start soliciting carriers' interest and in the participation in the exchange. And if you'll notice, a lot of those dates that are in there, it's starting to really look at user interface. Rather than planning, we really are in the next year and putting the pieces together, putting the paint on the car to make sure that this works, all the way up to October 2013 when we open the door for open enrollment in January of 14 when we begin coverage. So that just gives you kind of an idea of some of the main time frames that we're working under. The second slide, which is corporate update, I want to kind of go through really five different points. The first is quality assurance. As you know, we have Maximus Corporation that comes in and does a review of us on a monthly basis. And like all IT projects, and this is to some degree an IT project, it will continue to be read. This is a very high risk, short time frame project. And all of the quality assurance from both the IT side as well as the corporate side will continue to show red right up until we probably turn the switch of the engine to make sure it works. The second is, in November of this year, the federal government has asked that every state that's going to do an exchange submit what they call blueprint certification. That is the readiness of the exchange to that a state will be able to implement the exchange by the defined date. We've already submitted our application to the federal government. We're hoping to hear from them in the next month as to whether they will certify us. And And I will tell you that's, we're feeling pretty good about that because that's 3 months ahead of schedule. They weren't due to certify states until January of 2013, and we think we're going to receive a certification thumbs up from the federal government in the next 30 to 60 days. The other thing we're doing is planning to submit in November. What we call our Level 2 federal grant is the money that really covers all the expenses through 2013 and the first year of operation in 2014. So we're spending a lot of time trying to really make sure we can configure what kind of call centers we're going to have, what kind of customer service we're going to have, how many people we're going to need to go out and market, our agents, our navigator programs, and things like that. And I'm going to, because of short of time, I'm really not going to talk about these in too much detail. August Rush, that was named after a movie. That's where we all came together and said, let's rush through August and get as much done around business requirements as that we can get done.
I'm not familiar with that movie.
The example I use is that a business requirement is everything that the system has to do. And some of those requirements you won't know until the feds really give us all the regulations. We had a target of 80% of business requirements defined by the end of August. I think we reached 73%, so we continue to kind of work on that to make sure that we're up to date and able to tell our IT build folks exactly what they have to do with the system. The more important thing, though, is we're prioritizing the scope of services. You know, we want to have a car in 2014, and is it going to be a Chevy Nova from the 80s or a Cadillac? Well, it's going to be something in between. There's going to be a version 1.1 and a version 1.5. We're now really prioritizing those things that we have to have to make sure the exchange works and those things that are nice to have. Nice to have may be, for example, the ability for agents to go into the system and register for training. Well, you don't really need that for the exchange day one, but it would be nice to have. So that'll be version 1.5. So we're really prioritizing all the work right now. The next slide really gives you an overview of the IT project. Almost all areas of the exchange today have a working prototype, whether that's the shop program, the individual, finance, the portal for agents, customer service staff. We've really got the prototypes that we've built, and we're looking at prioritizing and sequencing, as I talked about through that prioritization of the scope, the work to focus on those things are really critical to have in October. We are holding joint application, or really design sessions, with the carriers to develop the carrier interface. Every other week, we meet with about 60 to 70 representatives from the 10 major, 12 major carriers that are interested in participating in the exchange to really look at how we're going to communicate back and forth on an IT basis with those carriers. We've already tested with a couple of those carriers and found that we've got the connectivity with those carriers in our IT system. And finally, we've got Deloitte on site developing a user interface, building on the work of IDO, which I've talked to you about before, and Sandstrom Partners, which is really our branding firm to look at, make sure the interface looks like an Oregon interface, not an Arizona interface. And we're doing a lot of work with around that. If you walk into our kitchen at our office, you would see, it's amazing, just all through the walls of the kitchen are all the web pages that are being designed, and the models are pinned up on the walls, and we go in there and work on them. It's quite unique. And I'll let Amy take over some of the stakeholder involvement.
Sure. Can I ask a question? I reviewed a paper for the National Academy of Social Insurance recently on the IT, and they said the federal government's putting a huge amount of emphasis on the transition between the enrollment system and the exchange, the link with Medicaid eligibility. And it seemed to me that they were requiring a completely integrated front end. Are we involved in that, and how close are we to having a completely transparent
Sure. Co-Chair Greenlee, I wish I had one slide here that shows kind of what we call the shared brain. And the center of that is eligibility, data management, and security. and that is shared by both the Medicaid side and what we call the commercial side, or public and private. So when somebody goes in that front door of that house, it's an integrated system, and they just, how that eligibility, they determine eligibility, and what is decided through that process sends them to a particular room, whether it's, you know, CHIP program for kids, CCOs, or whether it's individual or group market. So we are one of two or three states that are really trying to integrate that with Medicaid or the public and private. All other states and mostly on their exchanges are just doing the commercial side. That's what's created a lot of the challenges we have, given the time frames, is to develop that integrated system. So we're,
how are we doing with that? I read it saying that was a requirement of the exchange.
Yeah, we were working on it. I mean, we're doing the best we can. It's we've got the real challenge is that shared eligibility piece, because you have modernization that's happening on the Medicaid side, then you have the exchange, kind of the commercial side.
Co-Chair Greenlee, I think what you're asking is whether this is a federal requirement that we integrate these systems, and it is not a federal requirement that we do that. It is a choice that the state of Oregon made when they established the exchange, that this would be a priority for our work, and we're building our exchange in that way, but most other states are not.
Okay.
The next slide summarizes the stakeholder involvement work.
Your name?
I'm sorry. Again, my name is Amy Favre, Deputy Director of the Exchange, for the record. And the stakeholder involvement work, we've talked to you about it at each of our appearances. And so I'll summarize it very briefly and let you know what's new. We are continuing to hold multiple technical work groups on different issues. Since we last talked to you, we've had two different work groups focused on plan management. This is focused on the criteria for plans to be sold through the exchange. These are the qualified health plans. We have one work group of carriers looking at not only the criteria, but also some of the sort of the technical aspects of how they would comply and how they would respond to the RFA, the request for applications that we plan to put out October 1st. And the second group is focused on the consumer. So we have representatives from consumer advocacy organizations, from business associations, and other groups coming together to give us feedback on these criteria. We continue to have a tribal technical work group of actuaries, and then, as Rocky mentioned, a group of carriers focused on the IT interface. Our Consumer Advisory Committee continues to meet each month. They represent a wide variety of stakeholders. We bring them questions from staff that we'd like to have input on, and also from the board that they would like a broader perspective on. We continue to have regular check-in conversations with our Legislative Oversight and Advisory Committee. Four of you are here. Well, Rep. Thompson stepped out, but three of you are here at the moment. And our general consumer outreach, we're really starting to focus on, as we move toward 2013 and the launch of the open enrollment, how do we engage community-based organizations around the state to help us spread the word as we go into public education and really a marketing campaign next year. So we are, we've started bringing together a fairly, you know, small group of organizations that we're currently working with to give us advice on a path to do this, and then we'll be broadening that circle probably this fall or early next year with a larger meeting of community groups around the state who are interested, because, you know, for a lot of organizations, the work of helping their folks they serve get insurance is critical to their missions as well. So we'll be consulting with those organizations as we develop an outreach plan for 2013. And then we continue to receive public comment, both at our board meetings and through our website. We have, over the last several months, posted on multiple occasions key questions that we want public input on. Right now, we have posted on our website the criteria for qualified plans that are in the RFA that we intend to release October 1st. We've had those up for a couple of weeks, and we're taking public comment through this Friday, September 14th. So we've received some comment. I haven't gotten an update in the last week, but what we felt like we should get the word out a little bit more, so we've since engaged some of our partner organizations to help push that request for comment out to their memberships. So if you have folks who are interested in what the plans look like coming through the exchange, we encourage you to direct them to our website so they can submit us their comments as well. On the next slide, It's titled Enrollment and Financial Projections 2.0. If you think back to about a year ago at this time, we were talking about our business plan, and that's the business plan that the legislature approved in the February session. In that, we had our preliminary financial and enrollment projections, which we all knew were preliminary, and we've been working hard to update those. In the time since, we've contracted with the Wakely Consulting Group along with the Insurance Division to help us update our enrollment projections. Those are complete. They're very similar, actually, to what they were a year ago. What is still under development and still requires a bit more work on our part is developing our operating budget for the next 2 years. As Rocky mentioned, we're about to apply in November for our Level 2 operating establishment grant, and that grant takes us from the time of that grant all the way through the first year of operating the exchange, through 2014. We have waited until November to apply for that because we're still working through some of our decisions in terms of what does our call center look like, how is it staffed, you know, how robust of a model is it, and those impact our operating budget very significantly. So we will be finalizing those pieces of our work in the next 6 weeks. Once we have that established, then we'll be able to complete our financial projections and bring to you, probably next time we're before you, our updated financial enrollment projections that not only give our estimated cost of operating the exchange and the reserve for the first couple of years of operation, but also our estimated administrative fee that will be levied on carriers the first year.
So for the longer-term vision, there are really four things that I want to put on the table. First of all is the potential for large employers. This is slide 7. Secondly is really beginning to adopt and push into the private sector the care model that we think is going to come out of the transformation efforts on the Medicaid side. The third is, as I say, this more focus on quality and outcomes. We're working right now with OHA, for example, to align our metrics with the CCO metrics and the contracting there, so to require reporting on as many of the same things on both sides, both on the Medicaid and the commercial side. And finally, a lot of people talk about cost, is we want to get some enrollments that really will leverage some of our buying power, and we already know that some of the price competition is going to be there because of the visibility of how they're laid out and the plans comparing apples to apples. But those are kind of the four areas that we really want to focus on in version 2.0, or 1.1 and on, I should say. In terms of challenges, time frames. This is almost impossible to do. A lot of people say throw more staff at it, bring in 15 more project managers. The problem we have is a lot of the work is sequential. You know, you can't build the body to the car unless you have a frame and an idea of the engine and what it has to surround. So it's not just bringing people in and doing a whole bunch at the same time. It's sequential. So the time frames are just really, really tight. The scope of work, the complexity of the shared brain, and what we call the complexity of the build. Staffing is an issue. It's very difficult when you're in Salem to hire some of the technical staff you need to come down from Portland. And secondly, a lot of the technical staff right now are really in high demand. And we've had that problem on the IT side. We're actually opening an office in Portland besides our drop-in office to help alleviate some of the pressure, being able to draw some of the technical people from the Portland community. Customer service and call center strategies. I've talked about this before. What do you do on October 1st when you get 300,000 calls within the first week? How do you handle that? And it's, you know, we don't know if it's going to happen. We know in 1993 when we expanded OHP by 130,000 people that it brought down the system in that first couple months. They just didn't have the strategies in place to take those additional folks. So we want to learn from some of the past experiences. And finally, all the market changes that are going to occur in 2014. Guaranteed issue, the essential benefits. And there's going to be a lot of market disruption at the same time that we're rolling out the exchange. And so those are going to be some challenges from a communication standpoint in making sure people know where to go, what their choices are, and what the best choices for may be for them and their families. So that's a quick overview of where we are today. It's a little different than the last time. I'd be happy to entertain any questions, Madam Chair.
Question.
Yes, Senator Bates.
four real quick ones. I'm hoping that you're going to start interfacing with IT people from the insurance carriers pretty quickly. I've heard they're willing and want to help you out with the IT issues, and they want to interface with you right away. They don't want it delayed anymore, and they want to work with you. And I'm sure you've heard that, but I'm hoping you'll do that. Comment that when you get a chance. Next time in December, can you bring us the bronze plan and let us look at it really carefully? I'm worried about some mental health issues, autism issues, and some other issues inside that and what that cost, that plan might look like. Next time around, take a look at what's going to happen to the premiums for people who are above the 4% mark in the exchange, individual market primarily probably. What's going to happen to their premiums and what those premiums are going to look like. If you can even predict that, but do the best you can. And last, most important, can you deliver? Can you deliver? And you might want to bring LFO in next time. LFO is cautiously optimistic that you can deliver. They're not exuberantly optimistic, but they're cautiously optimistic, which gives me some optimism too. So maybe you could bring them in for your presentation in December. These are really questions you can answer next time around, not at the moment. We're kind of short of time.
All right, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, while we're in the process of questions, there's a conversation I was having with Senator Bates. He thinks that we can, under the current Medicaid waiver, we can do HSAs in Medicaid, and I would like some further definition on that, whether we can or not, because that would actually, if we can do that sort of concept in Medicaid, it might require a different waiver to lower the standard of bronze, assuming that the pot of money that people have will do some of the coverage. So that's somewhat of a complicating factor, but I think it's certainly something worth exploring, because we keep talking always about skin in the game, and that would be one way to get there. And another thing I know that we have passed legislation to move OEBB in. Are there conversations relative to PEB at this point in time in the exchange, and what's the time frame for that?
Next time.
Right. Madam Chair, do we have more than 10 minutes?
Next time. All right.
Next time.
Thanks. Madam Chair, these are important issues.
No, we agree.
Okay. Good
All right. Questions. Thank you very much.
You.
And with that, I would like to read. I forgot the briefing on the essential benefit package. Anthony.
And
Janine Smith. Sorry.
We have a huge pool. Chair Mona Sanderson, Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, Vice Chair Cruz. I'm Janine Smith from the Office of Health Policy and Research, and I'm accompanied here today with Anthony Behrens from the Insurance Division. Our two offices have worked together to do the first steps in our federal requirement to designate a commercial essential health benefit. That is sort of the basic floor for what some further work has been done, and some of which Rocky and Amy talked about in developing the requirements inside of the qualified health plan. So what you're being brought around is a two-page summary of this work group that was appointed by Governor Kitzhaber back in the spring. It was jointly overseen by the Oregon Health Policy Board and the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Board. They worked through the very rigid, somewhat rigid, I would say, requirements of looking at 10 plans at a point in time and very rigid regulations over what they could choose from to make that designation. This designation is for a plan that would apply to both inside and outside of the exchange. So it applies to the individual market and small group market outside of the exchange as well as inside the exchange. And as I said, it's the minimum benefit floor. They had certain choices, some of which were small group plans, some were federal employees plans, and then some of them were state employee plans to choose from. Through a grant that the Insurance Division had, we were able to employ Wakely Actuary
local firm to help us look at sort of the relative costs and the impacts on Oregonian families. And we also compared the choices to what was currently being offered in the individual market today and what the Oregon Health Plan standard benefit package looked like. So there was a series of meetings. There was public comment obtained at each of those meetings. Also, as they got closer to their decision, their draft choice was put out for public comment. All of that was brought back to the group to make their final determination, which was then passed on to the policy board and exchange board, who met in August 14th, precisely, to look at those choices. There was also public comment that was compiled between their all of that was compiled for their consideration. The boards then put forth the endorsed the selection that the work group had, which is the third largest small group market in Oregon at the point in time in which we were allowed to pick, which is a Pacific Source plan. And so the details are laid out here. What makes it an essential health benefit is that we needed to look to ensure that the choice had all 10 of the federally required essential benefits inside it. We did not look at cost sharing. We didn't look at premium. We just looked at sort of relative cost and what some of the differences were between the plans. The choice was then put forward to the governor and then on its route to go back to the federal government, which was is required to, we're required, but each state's required to report by the end of September. Some of the public comment we got was quite a bit around sort of wanting to get into the details of any precise benefit. The regulations from the feds is a little bit murky what this is the base sort of benchmark that plans could then offer essentially the same benefits. So how one plan manages inside of a particular benefit is not clearly defined at this point. It doesn't mean that just because Pacific Source does it one way that that's necessarily the way a particular benefit would need to be managed as we go forward with this being the inside of a qualified health plan or being offered on the market. The work also went on to, and Anthony can speak for a moment about that, the Senate Bill 91, which is to set the cost-sharing sort of similarities across the bronze and silver plans. So this was sort of the first step of a series of steps of here's the base content of the benefits. The 91 sort of sets the parameters around the cost sharing of what a bronze and silver to fit those requirements, and then that all goes forward to the qualified health plan options of what will be offered on the exchange. Separately will be a Medicaid benefit benchmark that needs to align with essential health benefits. The Medicaid Advisory Committee has just started thinking about this and are meeting on a monthly basis and should by the end of, most likely, hopefully, maybe by the time you meet in December, have an option or at least a draft decision on what they're going to recommend to the policy board that then the Medicaid agency would need, division would need to submit federal approval for. It doesn't have to be the same as this, and they have some limited choices there as well as to what they can choose from, or they can have a secretary-approved plan. So what is on this paper today is about the commercial choice, and there'll be further information coming to you, and I can give you further background, and there's some links on here to the Medicaid choice.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I have a sort of confusing question to ask you. In the Autism Commission, we were talking about the extent to which autism services might come under the habitation thing. And there was some statements about a federal restriction on not being able to change the benefit beyond what was offered in 2009, where the state would have to pay for all of that. Was that a Medicaid requirement and not a, I mean, is that involved in this as well?
Representative Greenlick and co-chairs, what the requirements around this are that when you get to the exchange, the subsidies are limited to only the mandates at a point in time that we had in the state. So if we have had picked a benefit package that has more additional benefits, there would not be federal subsidies to support those additional benefits.
Okay, could be in the premium thing? Is that...
Chair Moss Anderson, Co-Chairs Greenlee Thompson, and Vice Chairs. So what the feds require is that, I'm sorry, for the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm with the State of Oregon Insurance Division, Department of Consumer Business Services. So the federal guidance requires that for mandates enacted after December 31st of 2011, the state would be required to defray the cost of those, that portion of those, of the premium of those mandates for people who actually purchase in the exchange. There's some question about whether or not that's just limited to subsidy people or it's all people that purchase in the exchange, but the state would, I guess, for lack of a better term, be on the hook for that portion of the premium.
If you could send me a little information on that, that would be useful.
Absolutely.
Senator,
I want to follow up. We've had a long discussion about this. We have a work group that's getting ready to bring legislation forward for ABA treatment for autism. You know what that is, obviously. LC indicates to us they don't think that's a new mandate. As far as it's concerned, the state will not be on the hook for it. They think it comes under habitative care, and they think it's already covered, and it's something we're just going to define a little more closely. So we need clarification here. The first look at it said if you have this put in place as a new mandate, the state has to pay for it out of general fund dollars. Clearly, we don't think that's the case. LC doesn't think that's the case. They think there's a way of handling it. We'll talk about it some more. But it's under mental health, habitative care. We don't believe it's the way you've just outlined it, and that's something we need to talk to LC about some more, too.
Well, does putting it in the essential benefit package create a mandate, or is it just...
It should be in there already. So that's what I was asking earlier about the essential benefit package. We want some clarification there. And otherwise, we're going to be doing what we're doing now, handling each case by lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, which, by the way, have all been settled in the favor of the individual doing ABA.
That would be a question for CMS, then.
So it needs to be looked at carefully. The interpretation here is important. You need a clarification. My understanding from LC is this is covered.
Senator Bates, Chair Monis Anderson, Co-Chairs Thompson, Greenlee, Vice Chair.
Everybody.
I agree with you, Senator Bates. If it is already covered in the benchmark, it wouldn't be an additional benefit. If you look at the federal guidelines, they've been pretty clear that under their discussion of habilitative care, that ABA therapy specifically isn't required to be covered. So the real question is whether or not the Pacific Source Plan actually covers that now, and we've done a data call to kind of get the complete benefit package, and that's what we're looking at right now. So
they are the ones that lost the lawsuit and got it into them.
I believe they lost one of the lawsuits.
Yeah, and they did put it in their benefit.
Yeah, so I believe it's in there. Okay, I believe it's in there.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And with that, I would like to recess the Senate committee we are going right next door, straight next door. You can pick up some coffee and pastries on your way out, but we are moving over there. Thank you, Chair Greenlee and Thompson.
Alan, keep me in touch on that.
Yeah, well.
And we are not recessing the House Committee on Health Care, and let me call the next panel on spiritual care.
This is your
house. That's Mr. Kuhn, Mr. Bemis, Mr. Farisee. And please hold it down, because we're already about an hour behind.
Good morning, Chair Greenlee, Chair Thompson, members of the committee. I'm John Clegg, Christian Science Committee on Publication for Oregon. And our presentation is timed at 13 minutes. If you have questions, then it'd be good to have
minutes.
It at the end. With me today is Dr. Bob Faracci, MD, and Ken Bemis, an attorney with our church. When I retired from the Lane County Sheriff's Office 7 years ago, not in my wildest dreams did I think I'd be sitting here before the legislature talking about health insurance, but here I am. So why are we here? The current health system isn't meeting the needs of all Oregon citizens, as evidenced by rising costs and inequitable access. Current health systems overlook spirituality, and yet spiritual care provides a solution that will promote the mission of the Oregon Health Authority. That is helping people achieve optimum physical, mental, and social well-being through access to quality, affordable health care. The World Council of Churches has stated that the health industry is producing and using progressively sophisticated and expensive technology, and yet health is a factor of other issues such as spirituality. So what is spiritual care? It's that aspect of health care that attends to spiritual and religious needs brought on by an illness or an injury. So a spiritual care benefit then does provide a benefit to attend to those spiritual and religious needs. Research is increasingly showing that attending to spiritual needs has a positive effect on health. And I'd like to draw your attention to this 2-minute video that has 4 individuals talking about how they have used spiritual care to address their health care issues.
I was injured in high school playing football, damaged in my shoulder. I had surgery on it later. Was told by the physician that I would always have pain with that shoulder, especially during the winter because of an arthritic condition that would develop. I got to the point where I was in such pain at work one day that I had to go home. And I found a number of a Christian Science practitioner that I knew my wife called, and called him and asked him for help in Christian Science. And as I was hanging the phone up, I realized that the pain was gone. While I was extremely grateful for that healing, I realized about 2 weeks later that I'd been healed of alcoholism, that I hadn't had any desire for a drink for over 2 weeks.
Several years ago, I noticed a small growth on my eyelid, and over time it began to grow, and it was beginning to interfere with my vision, especially when I was driving. So I had been praying about this, but decided to go ahead and have it removed. The doctor said that the roots were deep and that they needed to be removed or the growth would return. So the earliest appointment was 2 months away, and during that time I continued praying. And one morning, while putting on makeup, I noticed the growth was completely gone and it has not returned.
I'm a retired electronics engineer. I live on a small income in Social Security. A few years ago, I was experiencing some pains that wouldn't go away. I mentioned them to a friend of mine who's a Christian Scientist, and I asked her how Christian Science healing works. She introduced me to a practitioner to whom I explained my ailments. The next day, the pains were gone. I should mention that I'm not a Christian Scientist then or now, but I have found Christian Science healing to be fast, effective, and inexpensive.
I'm a professional ballet dancer, and several years ago I was training to compete in a prestigious ballet competition, and I fell and sprained my ankle pretty severely. I called a Christian Science practitioner to pray with me, and within about a week and a half I was back to dancing full out, and when I got to the competition, I got several comments about how strong my dancing looked.
We know from research reported by the American Psychological Association that Americans are increasingly using prayer to address their health care issues. There's no reason to believe that trend won't continue. Coverage of spiritual care is not a new concept. Many top employers cover spiritual care through their health benefit plans. You can see large corporations such as Boeing, Intel, GE, etc. And many top U.S. insurance carriers administer plans covering spiritual care. And I want to point out two particularly, Aetna. Dr. Faraci will be talking about them just in a minute. And Providence administers the public employee benefit plan for the state of Oregon.
Chairman Greenlick, Chairman Thompson, and members of the committee, my name is Robert Faraci. I am a medical doctor, and I am a former chief medical officer at Sloan's Lake Managed Care in Denver, Colorado. I'm not a Christian Scientist, although, as you can see, I work with them, and I'm not here today as a physician. I'm here as a former health plan executive because I hope to convince you that spiritual care is good for patients, that it is cost-effective, improves medical outcomes, and most importantly, is actually easily integrated into the healthcare system. Now, people will tell you that that's not possible, that you cannot integrate spiritual care providers into the health plans of this country. It simply cannot be done. I am here to tell you that it can be done, and the reason I can say that is because I've done it. Let me tell you about the Sloan's Lake experience. Sloan's Lake was the first HMO in the United States to cover spiritual care and to have a spiritual care benefit. This was an actual benefit that was to our members. It was not a rider, so it was an actual integral part of our plan. The details are in your handouts that we've given you, so I won't go into great detail about the actual benefit package. But we were able to do this with no increase in premium, much to the chagrin of our underwriters. And we also found that it was actually quite easy to integrate the spiritual providers into the system. We were able to credential them, we were able to do coding for them, and we were able to bring them into our billing system very easily. What we found was there was high member satisfaction on our member satisfaction surveys. People really wanted this service, and when they had this service, they really thought it was a great service. The other thing we found is that our loss ratio did not increase as a result of adding this service, because again, this was done with no increase in premium. The thing that did increase was the demand for the product. The HMO grew 400% within 2 years of the initiation of this product, and it was the fastest growing health plan in the state of Colorado. So the moral is, if you want to grow your health plan, have a spiritual care benefit. Aetna is also getting into this business. They discovered that their highest stress employees were costing them $2,000 more on an annual basis on medical costs than lower stress employees. And they did a study in conjunction with Duke University's Integrative Medicine Group and found that when relaxation techniques and Vinayoga were used with these high-stress individuals, they had marked reduction in their stress levels, and of course that translates into decreased costs. They were so impressed with this that they now offer this to all their employees, and they're even offering it to self-insured groups that they administer. Closer to you all in Alaska, not too far away, is the South Central Foundation. This is a highly integrated medical care system with heavy emphasis on spiritual care and on spiritual healing. They also use a lot of Native Alaskan healing techniques. As you can see in this slide, they've had marked decreases in virtually everything as far as their regular medical care is concerned. And the remarkable thing about this is that they have been able to keep their cost increase down to 2% annually, when medical costs, as you well know, throughout the country have gone between 5 and 12% increases on an annual basis. And they've been able to keep these 2% increases with increasing membership of 7% on an annual basis. Finally, here's what we are doing at this time. We have created a Christian Science Spiritual Care Independent Practice Association. This is a different model from the Sloan's Lake model. The Sloan's Lake model was a health plan model. This is a provider model. We now have providers in a network that is registered and incorporated in the state of Massachusetts. And we are currently negotiating and contracting with Aetna in the state of Massachusetts through their PPO to be in-network providers for Aetna's PPO plan. We do credentialing, we do coding, and more importantly, we do electronic billing. So all of these things can be accomplished with a spiritual care network. Our intent at this time, the network includes Christian Science practitioners, Christian Science nurses, and a Christian Science nursing institution. But our goal is to increase this and expand it to include other religious providers and also non-religious providers to have a broad-based spiritual care network that we can take nationally, and we can contract with health plans throughout the United States. In summary, spiritual care leads to tangible improvements in health. Aetna has shown this. South Central has shown this. In addition, we have a great deal of information and bibliography that we've given you, which there are a number of studies that also support these same conclusions. It easily integrates into existing plan coverages. We've now done it two different ways, one through a health plan and one through a provider group. It's increasingly sought by the public, absolutely no question about that, with our Sloan's Lake experience. And there's also evidence from the Templeton Foundation, where a study was done by them that showed that 55% of Americans would choose a health plan that addresses their spiritual needs. And it drives down cost. Aetna has found this, South Central has found this, and again, in your bibliography, you'll identify many other papers and scientific articles that demonstrate the same thing. Mr. Bemis.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Ken Bemis, and I'm a legislative attorney with the Christian Science Church. Even though I currently live in St. Louis, Missouri, my roots are here in Oregon. I went to law school just around the corner at Willamette, lived here for about 25 years, and was in private practice up in Portland before moving to the Midwest. We at the church are closely watching the developments of health care reform, both
at
the federal... Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll turn the lights on here. You're going to use slides. Okay.
Yeah, we're quite not there yet, but we're closely watching the impact of healthcare reform and its impact on the public's access to spiritual forms of care in relation to health. And I want to start by emphasizing we are not proposing that this be mandated. It's probably a relief to many ears. Although spiritual care, we believe, has proven to be cost-effective and to promote healthy outcomes, we understand the challenges of mandating an additional benefit or a new benefit, and are not suggesting you do so at this time. So what are we seeking? We are looking for solutions through policy at this point, and we're asking you to expressly affirm through policy that spiritual methods of care fit within the health insurance reform framework for health plans operating both inside and outside of the exchange. The other thing we're asking for Oregon to consider are ways in which insurance carriers can achieve cost reduction or health improvement and possibly gain incentives for doing so. An example of this being done is up north in Washington. The state of Washington had a bill this earlier this year in their regular session, HB 2319, which passed into law. They did two things. They adopted similar policy language to what we're throwing to you to consider that would identify the permissibility of plans covering spiritual health care benefits. They went a step further, and not something that we asked, but after hearing our presentation and the ideas, they actually went forward to create an incentive for insurance companies to cover spiritual care through its rating system on the exchange for qualified health plans. We want to ask Oregon to consider some very simple language, and when the next session comes around, to at least embrace and create a footpath to go down that will acknowledge that spiritual care can participate in these health plans, whether they're on the exchange or outside of it. I should mention that just last week, California also passed two health care reform bills related to its exchange implementation, both of which had very similar policy language regarding spiritual care in them. So the West Coast is starting to fill out, and Oregon can clean that lineup. We believe this policy language will do three things. One, we think it will ensure consistent administration with the intent of the federal ACA. In your packets, we have included some excerpts from some colloquies and comments by federal legislators who were key in the healthcare reform dialogue and who felt it was very important to come in and address spiritual care in relationship to those reforms. Secondly, we feel that having this policy language will help remove some of the uncertainty that might discourage insurance companies from offering spiritual care options. And finally, we believe this promotes the mission of the Oregon Health Authority by enhancing patient access to health coverage options that foster quality and value, and I think addresses each of the three prongs of Representative Conger's stool that he was talking about earlier. We thank you for your attention. We know things are moving quickly, but we wanted to reserve some time to answer any questions you may have.
Good. Are there any questions? I do want to comment. I think many of us have been involved in using one form of care or another. I was diagnosed several years ago with a particular nasty form of lymphoma, and blended guided visualization and meditation with the very modern forms of chemotherapy. I attribute both of them to the fact that I'm still around. But what are the barriers? I mean, that language to say nothing should be a barrier, what would be the impact of that, except a symbolic impact?
Well, maybe a good example to look at is in Oregon's own law in Chapter 243 regarding the PERS state plan. There's permissive language in it that talks about PEBS' ability to include spiritual care benefits in the plan. It's not mandatory, but it's permissive. And it has created an avenue and an acknowledgement, in a sense, in policy that really permits that to go forward. I don't want to speak on behalf of insurance companies, but you know, they tend to be risk averse, and if it isn't clear, especially as they're trying to meet the requirements to be qualified on the exchange or otherwise, they're going to do everything they can to meet those requirements, but not necessarily go far beyond that. So we're hoping that at least some policy language will help create the mindset to look at this.
And do you have somebody prepared to introduce that legislative concept?
We will be prepared to introduce that, yes.
Well, you can introduce it. You need a member to introduce it.
Oh, you mean a member of the... Yeah, we'll be working with members of...
Not yet.
The website. We want to try and do it by Friday.
Okay.
This Friday.
Yeah, our deadline is Monday for asking for a LC that would be introduced as a pre-session introduction. It can happen later than that, but if you have very simple language and you have a member to do that, you have till 5 o'clock Monday to get the request in for pre-session filing. So you might talk to the members, you might get somebody requested as a committee or something. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Chair. My question was just similar to yours in that the legislative request that you're seeking is to limit any prohibition against inclusion. And I'm just curious as to, I think it's just another way of asking the same thing, what is the prohibition that currently exists in statute in Oregon that you would be trying to address? Because as I understand it, there is no prohibition. It's just many are not adopting it.
Co-chairs and Representative Geyer, I think you're absolutely correct. There is no restraint in the law. I think there's some practical considerations and obstacles that do get in the way. Most of the focus is on delivery of medical care. And not some of the things that surround that in a patient's decision on what elements of care to choose. There certainly isn't a legal prohibition, but there could be a practical restraint from spending much time in that area if it's not acknowledged in the law. My experience has been, and we've worked with a lot of different states in regard to spiritual care over the years, and Massachusetts is a good example, where if it wasn't addressed in the law, some of the companies in the area were unwilling to mark new territory or go into areas where it wasn't clear. And we feel that it's good policy, at least, to acknowledge that so that there aren't any questions about qualification or ability to meet the standards that are in place. Most of the people I speak with that are in the industry acknowledge that and appreciate the clarity that would be brought forward with a policy like that, and we don't see much objection from anyone on this. It's not offensive to anybody, and it addresses whether it's religious or non-religious. This can benefit an atheist or someone who delves more deeply into a religious element of spirituality. So it really meets a variety and breadth of needs.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very interesting presentation. Can we have Scott Eggblatt talk about rural health?
I'm obsessive. I don't want to see that. It's going to psych you out.
Mr. Chair, I'm telling you for Scott's day.
Okay. Thought we were going to have to wake him up back there. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Dumig. I work with the Office of Rural Health here in Oregon.
It's not that we don't consider this important. We consider it really important, but would you try it? We're way behind. So
yep, I certainly can. I am sorry that Scott's not here today, but we wanted to report on a couple of the findings that have come out on workforce issues that face Oregon, in particular rural Oregon, with the creation of CCOs and the hoped expansion of Medicaid and increased access of coverage for Oregonians. We need to focus and stay focused on knowing that there will be enough providers for those patients to see in the future. So I won't go over everything that's in here. There are some great statistics, such as over 30% of active professionals licensed and reported by participating board organizations are 55 years and older. And that is going to have an impact as those providers get to a little bit closer to retirement age and know that we have the ability to either recruit providers to our state or to grow them ourselves. Currently, Oregon has a few programs that we use to attract and get providers here. The Primary Care Services Loan Repayment Program, which is currently unfunded, but there is a requirement for federal within the federal assistance with our health transformation that we fund a loan repayment program. One is the Oregon Partnership State Loan Repayment Program, a federally funded program that we match local site dollars with to help pay off loans for providers. There's a primary health care loan forgiveness program, which began last year. It allows us to forgive loans for students who are going into medical school now and agree to come back and practice in rural communities. There's a rural provider state income tax, which currently 2,000 people in 2011 were eligible for. It is set to sunset this next year, so you will hear us talking about that a lot in the next coming years, coming months. And we do have some information we hope to be able to bring back soon from a survey we've done of rural providers. And finally, the Rural Medical Practitioners Insurance Subsidy Program, which is also key to keeping some of our providers in the rural area. So there are links here in the testimony as well to get you to all of the reports that are available, and we are always available to answer any questions that you may have.
Do we need LCs at any of those sunsets in this session?
It is possible. I can find out and let you know shortly.
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, do you have any discussion?
No, I just reiterate what I've said consistently, that we better have a way of covering rural health care as we go down this road. So I think it's a huge, huge area of concern.
Bob, how far away are we from what we need?
You know, there's no one center place for current positions to be listed in the state of what's available. This is the first of the information that we've been able to get on from health boards reporting the data of ages and intentions of cutting back hours and retiring, etc. So I think we are at the point where if we're not focusing on it now, if as we hope to be successful in the transformation of healthcare and increasing access to health insurance, if we are not focused in building and continuing those programs we have now, we will be in a world of hurt over the next few years.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Just got a quick curiosity. Does your office track populations within rural health? And do you have, you don't have to have data today, but like, you know, people with specific health ailments or specific populations, seniors or, you know,
we, the people that come up? Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, we do have some of that information that we could pull for you, yes.
Okay, that'd be great.
Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Let's see, Mr. Burns. You can't hide back there. Yet.
Good
co-chairs and members. I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. You've asked me to do a quick update on two subject areas, and I can make it real quick. They're both working just fine. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. Oh, not that quick. Sorry. Okay. Sorry. I thought I'd try it. I'll do them in the order of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program first, followed by the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. The Oregon Prescription Drug Program is a program that was created by you and then subsequently augmented by a ballot initiative to provide discounted drugs for those persons who did not have a drug benefit or do not have drug insurance coverage. Now, I worded it that way on purpose because everyone in this room could be and should be a member of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, because I guarantee you, you will sometime in your life get prescribed a drug that your insurance company probably won't cover. And the Oregon Prescription Drug Program can get that drug for you at a discounted price. You're shaking your head, but it is open to everybody, yes. And it is open to anybody who wants to use it, and it is simply a matter of applying. We have 410,000 people in the state of Oregon who are part of this program. 230,000 of them are the discounted program. The other 170,000 consists of OEB, SAFE, the Oregon OHSU, and our most recent group, which is the Multnomah County employees, are the commercial side. For the discounted program, that is people who are getting drugs at a discount, we estimate that through the end of July, I haven't got the August numbers yet, we've saved taxpayers $9 million. People who simply can't want to have a discounted drug program, we've saved them $9 million. So the program is working, it's moving forward, it's just fine. We are in the process of getting ready to provide a proposal to PEB, who is looking for a new drug benefit as part of the overall medical review, and we will be working with them to hopefully provide the benefit to the state employees as well. So that's the PDM, Prescription Drug Monitoring Program.
No, wait a minute. Are there any comments or questions on Representative Conner?
Just 2 points of clarification, Mr. Burns. One, you said save $9 million. What's that compared to?
That would be if they were to walk in without being a member. If they walked in to buy their prescription drugs without being a member, they would have paid $9 million more than they did by being a member.
They didn't have any other discount.
Right.
Kind of.
Okay. Right.
I actually just lost the second question, but I'll come back.
What's the time period for that $9 million?
Through the end of July. This year.
Half
yes.
The year.
Yeah. Since the beginning of the program, it's about $57 million in savings. So we're running right around $6 to $7 million a year. That didn't work either. My math isn't working.
I'll confuse him with another question while you're thinking of it.
I got mine back, so whenever you're ready.
Oh, go for it.
You said that you were trying to allow PEB and OEB, I think, to have this benefit, but Bernie said that anybody can sign up for it.
OEB is currently part of it as a commercial side, as a typical insurance commercial program, where we provide discounted drugs by going to drug manufacturers and negotiating rebates, building a pharmacy network for the OEB clients, and functioning as any other drug benefit program that might be out there. PEB is not part of this. They are going out to bid for their new medical benefit sometime this fall, and we will be an active participant in that.
So any plan can sign
yes.
up?
Yes.
Not any individual?
Individuals can sign up for the discount side. Plans sign up for the essentially the commercial side.
Okay.
The question I have is this. In its origin, was all carried, the discount program, on essentially the back of the pharmacist. We've been trying over time to find some ways to supplement this. Have you been successful in that at all?
That is one of my biggest frustrations, as you know, Representative Greenlick. The problem we have is that the only way to subsidize this program is to get discounts or rebates from drug manufacturers. Because there are Medicare-eligible people in the program, the federal government has said to the drug manufacturers, you cannot provide an incentive to use your drugs if you want to be part of the Medicare Part D program. We have looked at potentially removing anybody over 65 from the program. The problem is that enters into, there are people who don't have a Part D plan or who do want to get it because their Part D plan is limited. It is a frustrating situation. I know when I worked for a pharmaceutical company, we examined it closely. We would have liked to do it, but we couldn't because of the federal anti-kickback laws that says you cannot incent somebody to use your drugs by giving them discount.
Thank you. Okay, next program.
Okay, prescription drug monitoring program. This is a program that you established in 2009 that is designed to provide a resource for doctors to and pharmacists to know what the patient in front of them, what kind of drugs the patient is using. Now, it's not all drugs. It's only those drugs that are subject to DEA rules, which is the scheduled drugs. Those drugs that have a potential for misuse or overabuse or become addicted to. So every time a prescription is filled by a pharmacy that for one of these types of drugs, the data is put into the prescription drug monitoring program, and then a provider or a pharmacist, if he suspects abuse, can look up the data for the patient in front of him and know all of the types of drugs that the patient has gotten. It is we hope that it is a program that will continue to expand and be used by providers as a means to have conversations with their patients. We currently have about 4,500 healthcare providers, and it is anybody who is licensed to prescribe one of these drugs. Not all licensed providers prescribe these drugs. You have to not only be licensed as a doctor or a neuropath or an OD or a nurse practitioner, you also have to have a DEA number, which is a second step where the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration gives you a license. So we have 4,500 of those people who are actively using the program. They've made over 200,000 queries into the system. That is, they've looked and said, I've got Tom in front of me today. I want to know whether I am the only person who is prescribing drugs to Tom, or is Tom getting drugs someplace else? Because what we have learned in the world of prescription drug abuse is people doctor shop and pharmacy shop. And so this is a mechanism by which doctors can have conversations. They can make their decision on what they want to do. We're not telling doctors what to do. We're simply saying, Doc, look up Tom's records, see what Tom's using, and if it looks like abuse, have a conversation with Tom. You know, you may discover that there's a legitimate reason why 2 weeks ago Tom got 100 tablets of OxyContin that you didn't know about because you didn't prescribe it. But if you know about that and Tom is in front of you for a benzodiazepine, you don't want to prescribe that because there's an adverse reaction between opioids and benzodiazepines. So you don't want to prescribe that. You want to find another way to treat Tom's mental illness or figure out when you can get Tom off the opioid and use the mental illness. It is a tool that we hope doctors will use. In the last couple months, we did a survey of over 100 users in the system, both registered and non-registered, that is users who are actually using it and users who could use it, but who are not, to find out what they're using. 92% reported that they believe the program is likely to improve management of patient prescriptions for controlled substances. So the providers actually see there's an opportunity here. 78% reported that the program is useful in helping to monitor patients' controlled substance prescriptions. Again, if Tom's doctor shopping, the doctor will know that that is occurring by using this program. And 76% reported it would be helpful in controlling doctor shopping. Again, Tom, why did you go see this other doctor before you came to see me? Is there something going on that we need to talk about? It is a program that's up and operating, and I provided to the committee administrator some statistics about the program that is should be in your packets. It's very interesting to see what kind of drugs are being used. One of these has, on the bottom left-hand side of this has a list of the 12 top prescriptions, and as you might guess, hydrocodone is oxycodone, both opioids, are the two largest users, followed by my favorite drug, literally my favorite drug, Zolpidem, which I use for those nights when I don't sleep well. It's Ambien is the brand name. And then some of the other drugs down there, you can see the number of prescriptions that are in it and the number of uses. You can also then see by county the larger users of the program and see where those providers are that have been using the program. I don't want to say it's a 100% success. We're still growing. We've been live for a little over 1 year, but it is a program that is being used. It is a program that is being looked at, and I am pleased to announce that the National Governors Association just today announced a $45,000 grant to the state of Oregon to expand on what we're doing with the Oregon Prescription Drug Program and to build a better program for prescription drug abuse. So. We're now have moved out of Oregon into the national level, and I think it's a program that will continue to build.
Tom, will you talk about use by law enforcement?
Sure. We've had three law enforcement requests. They were all met the standard in our law, which is that it has to be a court order, and we provided the information that they were looking for.
Great.
We've had no data breaches.
Sounds great. Any other? Yes, sir.
Just for the record, I got a call from a dentist here in Salem yesterday on this issue who had a patient come in asking for Vicodin for a tooth problem. And the dentist wrote the prescription, got a call 20 minutes later from a pharmacist wanting to know if the dentist knew that that patient had filled a prescription for 275 Vicodin at 10 in the morning.
Wow. 275.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on out there that we should be able to learn about as this becomes more sophisticated. And being number two in the nation for drug abuse, some wonderful distinction like that, you know, this may be a tool to help address some of that.
Senator Conger.
Mr. Burns. Psychotropic drugs, these are part of the same database system?
Yes.
So there was a bill that passed, I can't recall the number, last year that required the release of certain data, not including patient information, but use and pricing, I think, to the Central Oregon Health Council. I've seen a couple of emails fly by. I have to admit I haven't zeroed in and focused on this carefully, but I think it was mandatory, and I'm wondering why the data has not been delivered.
Co-chairs, Representative Conger, the data is being delivered. We met our deadline as required in statute of July 1st to provide the data. We worked with not only the Central Oregon Consortium, but also all of the other MCOs, now CCOs, to build a data system to provide that for them. When we provided the data, we did not provide the cost of the drug. That was a decision that we made internally. We made that decision because included in that at the time was some confidential information around for pharmacists. And we did not want to allow some competing pharmacists to figure out what our contracts are with those pharmacies. We are in the process and anticipate on October 1st to be able to strip that out and provide just the ingredient cost without the confidential data about how we reimburse our pharmacies.
Okay. I think the cost was the whole point of the delivery of the data.
Understand what the Central Oregon concern is. The cost is not what they were looking for. I mean,
it is what they were looking for.
Well, what we wanted to do was be able to say to the physical health provider, here's what the mental health side of your patient's medicine is doing. because the mental health providers were writing the script, and the physical health providers, because we were paying for it, couldn't see the script and didn't know if the patient was being filled, was being used, was being abused. So now that data is there. It was there on the 1st of July. The cost data is coming and will be available on October 1st.
Committee members, okay. It's my intention to hold in until 11:30. I invite as many of you to stay with it as you can to try and get through the agenda. Representative Hoyle?
Thanks for the presentation. That's helpful. And to follow up with Representative Conger's question, my understanding was as well that the pilot that was happening in Central Oregon was specifically to be able to get information in a real-time basis to physical health care providers, because it could be 4 to 6 weeks before they got information on the psychotropic medication that was being given to certain patients, and there are physical health effects. There's also contraindications that certain drugs have, and if you really want to look at how to manage, getting people the appropriate health care and the appropriate, medication management, you have to have your health care provider understanding the full spectrum of what's being prescribed. And again, in terms of integrating behavioral and physical health care, it doesn't make sense that any health care provider or physician wouldn't have access to the entire spectrum of medication that was being provided. So this was one way to see if we could reduce the number of medications that people are on, but also ensure that they're getting the right type of medication for what their physical and behavioral health concerns are. I know that there are other counties, other CCOs that are interested in this pilot, and also in getting that information in a real-time fashion. So my understanding is that, rather than cost, was the driving force in putting that forward, because it really does, there are some major physical health ramifications that were happening because of that lack of information.
And I'll respond and tell you that I'm not the expert on this particular issue, but I'm pretty sure it was both, because part of transformation involves cost savings.
Really?
And I know it's a foreign concept, but you're absolutely right, Val, that it's both. It's having that broader scope and looking at the possibility of abuse or drug interactions, all the things that Mr. Burns was talking about generally about the database. But in addition to that, it was looking at what the cost of different drugs were and what the savings that could be realized by this kind of coordination, specifically in these kinds of drugs. The other drug data is already available. This kind of drug data wasn't, is my understanding. And so the cost is actually a critical component to making a determination about, for example, could you hire someone to track these? You know, does it, if you do a good job of managing it, does it justify the cost of hiring someone to track them? I mean, I'm just speculating, but so it's both.
Yeah, and just why I know, just one more comment. I agree with you that cost and better outcomes were the reasons for setting up the pilot. But what I would like to caution is to say, especially with mental health drugs, sometimes the right mental health drug costs a lot, but if it keeps someone out of a state hospital, and if it means that they can actually be functioning because they have one drug that may be more expensive, and have their doctor be able to attend to the physical health care needs, whether it be diabetes that came in because a mental health drug affected their pancreas or shut it down, or some other thing, making sure that we have the right medication as opposed to the wrong medication or many medications, or someone who's just not compliant and needs a community health worker to go in and make sure they're taking that medication daily or having access to some alternative treatment. I think that's also where we get the lower health care costs. My only concern is that the cost of a particular medication is a factor, but that is not the most important factor in driving down healthcare costs. It's getting people the right treatment at the right time. So
clearly, I just want to say I totally agree.
Great.
I don't think there was anything in what we passed to provide that pilot that runs counter to that at all in intent or spirit or language, certainly. But hiding the ball on costs is not going to serve any purpose. So that was more my point.
Thank you. Tom, before you go, Representative Thompson says the Pharmacy Benefit Management Work Group is doing very well.
Yeah, I think we're moving ahead well, and Tom has been a big help on that. We have some concepts that will be coming out very, very soon. Any comments you want to?
It's been a fascinating conversation, and I am unfortunately sort of caught in between. I have two jobs. One job is to build a pharmacy network through a PBM that is a broad pharmacy network that serves as many people as I can and as least costly as possible. On the other hand, my job is to find a way to reduce the overall cost of drugs as much as I can. And the two of them arguably are in conflict, because to the extent that I can reduce the payments to pharmacy, I save on the other hand. But if I reduce the payments to pharmacy too far, I lose my pharmacy network, and people are not going to be able to go to their corner pharmacy. I think it's going to be very interesting to find the fine line that sort of wanders us through there, that gives the pharmacists the kind of protection they need against large PBMs, of which we are one, so that we can get, so they can stay in business and yet keep the cost low enough so that we can continue to be good stewards of the taxpayers' money.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Can I ask Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Parrish to talk about the direct entry midwives now, and then we'll go to the Republic Health First Aid. No, you can stay where you are.
Okay.
Yeah. Want me to start off?
Yeah.
Say a couple things and then pass it over to Representative Parrish. We've been working on this. We are co-chairing a committee that Representative Hoyle has joined us on, and has been staffed by Sandy very ably. And we are accompanied by several members who have been participating in the work group. We have two direct entry midwives, Silke Akerson and Shafia Monroe. We have two spots for a certified nurse midwife, Monica Arce, and then Kate Pelosi has taken over for Judith Rooks. We have one naturopathic physician and midwife, Sarah Gucci, and we have two medical doctors, Alan Hedges and Duncan Nielsen. So they've been great. We've met, we as legislators met on the phone one time, and then we've had five meetings with this group. Our goal is to promote safe home birth as part of a comprehensive care that we offer in Oregon. And in alignment with the whole health transformation and CCO model, we really see this as a part of a continuum of care where we're able to support home births as a part of a patient-centered quality health care that actually costs less. But what has happened over many years is that practice is often offered a little bit outside of the continuum of care of the dominant medical culture, and we're trying to find a way by working with all sides to bring that continuum of care in alignment. And so we are prepared to present a concept to LC that is almost ready that will mandate licensing for home midwifery. Along with that, there will be exemption for traditional midwives that we're working out. There are a lot of different pieces to it, but along with the mandating license, we need to look at issues of some of the barriers to licensing, which include very high cost. We're looking at what are the standard minimums of education, standards of practice, scope of practice, investigation, how investigations are done, and so what is a governance structure in the licensing agency that can really align with those values. So I think we've made a lot of progress.
I'll just add, this is a group that has had some kind of disparate interests, and if you look at midwifery is kind of a medical brand, when you've got these different practitioners who are practicing, but when you see a bad outcome in the paper, you know, all of those folks get lumped together. We're trying to do things that will kind of not see us be demonized, or see the home birth segment be demonized, which we've seen some of that in the media, and to bring a level of professionalism to this. Not that there already wasn't, but by branding this a little better and putting a licensure piece into that, we want these folks to be able to provide a safe alternative option for childbirth at home. So the fact that these groups have come together and we use kind of a facilitated dialogue of trying to create some common core values across the medical practice, the scope of practice with the hospital side, having some conversations about what happens when you transport. So I feel like we've come a long way. And the LC draft that you'll get will actually have, like I said, five, six meetings worth of work where people have found a way to come to the middle, find the things that they agree on, and start from there. But then I think that there's some room further past this LC to look at some of the other issues and to, even if they're not necessarily, would have a subsequent legislation, but at least to kind of move that profession in the right direction and getting them working with traditional providers a little better and hospitals a little better and to create reducing some of the barriers to the process.
Will it be a placeholder in by Monday?
I believe, yeah.
And then I hear what you said, it'll be a larger report to us about further actions. Huh?
Yep.
We'd be happy to do another report in December. We do have at least one more meeting planned in October and November.
Yep, two.
So we will continue
working.
You're
doing a great job. It's a very tough problem.
It's a very tough. That is one of the toughest healthcare questions happening. It's not CCOs, it's the white. And so anyway, we're pleased with the work. It's been a good team, and feel like we've gotten a lot done. And then a lot of people who come and presented, the Health Licensing Authority folks have been there to work with us. They've done a great job. So.
And the other thing I'd just say is just we're trying to find that sweet spot between consumer access, because we really believe that this is a service that aligns very well with the whole health transformation, and consumer protection. And so
that's about an interesting problem with each of the board discussions we're getting into, how to balance those two things.
Well, the piece here is that we want to make sure that, coming into licensure for the midwives, isn't in a creates an artificial hammer of punitive. They want to participate and they want to be in a kind of more formal role.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I'll ask Dr. Oxman and Mr. Duncan to join us. Can I just remind all of you, as you just heard, we have this LC deadline coming up. If you want something to be submitted by the committee that you have, get it to Sandy, we'll get it in. If you want it submitted by your own, we can decide again whether it'll be a committee bill or not, if you want it to be a committee bill in December. So just individually submit them if you want, and then we'll let us know. We'll introduce them as a committee bill when we introduce them.
The midwife will be a committee bill. We'll be dropping it as a committee bill.
Great.
Okay.
Gentlemen. Introduce yourself and roll.
Yes. So we're having technical difficulties with our PowerPoint, but my name is Ben Duncan with Multnomah County Health Department, and we're here today to discuss bed bugs.
We're going to miss your presentation.
Well, we can probably talk through some of it. We'll be
all right, go.
Adaptable. So we're here specifically to discuss a legislative concept, but first I'll have Dr. Gary Oxman talk about the public health perspective.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Greenlick, Thompson, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Gary Oxman. I'm the health officer for Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, and I'm going to provide you just with a little bit of public health background as context to the discussion about our needs here today. We had some lovely pictures of bed bugs to show you, but we can't because the slideshow is not working. But in any case, bed bugs are an insect. They're fairly small things. They're about 3/16 of an inch long, and they grow somewhat when they take a blood meal. And bed bugs feed exclusively on animal blood, human blood specifically. And what they do is they nest in small cracks and other small spaces in people's living quarters. The bugs themselves are fairly small, about 3/16 of an inch, so they can hide readily. A female bed bug can lay as many as one 112 eggs per day, and they live about 12 to 18 months. So a female can lay well over 500 eggs in her lifetime. The eggs themselves are tiny, less than a 16th of an inch, and again, they're laid in cracks, and so very, very difficult to detect. So the big question is, why are we concerned about bed bugs from a public health perspective? And I want to start by saying we are not concerned about them because they spread disease. Often in public health, we get concerned about insects because they spread disease, West Nile, malaria, dengue fever, etc. Bed bugs do not spread disease. There have been a number of studies looking at this. You can induce bed bugs to carry certain germs. For example, there was a study recently looking at bed bugs and finding that they could be made to carry MRSA or resistant staph infections in homeless folks. But there was no evidence from that study or a wealth of other studies that bed bugs actually transmit disease. So you might be asking yourself, then why are you concerned from a public health perspective? And we're concerned because bed bugs are a community health problem. They do cause physical symptoms. They cause very itchy bites, and when people scratch those bites, they can become infected with bacteria, and people can get either minor or significant infections from that. They cause a lot of anxiety and stress. People get very, very concerned about bed bugs and constant itching, and people mostly just get creeped out by the feeling that there are bugs in their environment. And that they're there waiting to bite them. And in a lot of cases, that actually leads to significant sleep disturbance or insomnia. But more importantly, we're really concerned about bed bugs because they disrupt people's lives, and they disrupt their businesses, and they potentially impact entire industries. So it becomes more of a quality of life and an economic issue. For people whose dwellings are infested with bed bugs, it's a lot of work for the impacted person and their family and housemates to try to deal with the problem. It creates a lot of anxiety, frustration, and conflict among family members and among people living in a place, and often among apartment neighbors who accuse each other of being the source of the bugs. And it creates a lot of additional work and stress for landlords and hotel operators. In addition, it costs money to carry out treatment and the ongoing detection and prevention activities. And bed bugs really cause a loss of reputation for businesses. These can be really devastating for apartment buildings and hotels in particular. And just anecdotally, I've had a number of people tell me when we talk about bed bugs that they would never go to New York City and stay there as a tourist because they are aware that there's a lot of bed bug activity in New York. And we don't want to get in a similar place here in Oregon. And finally, bed bugs lead people to inappropriate chemical application. They take insecticides and they figure, well, one bug killer is as good as any other bug killer. And they apply it on a do-it-yourself basis. And what ends up happening is a couple things. One is it doesn't work and can even make the bed bugs more resistant to treatment, and secondly, can result in chemical exposure for people. So in addressing bed bugs, and Ben will talk about the example what we've done in the Portland area, we basically use the tools that we use for other public health problems. We can't eliminate bed bugs, but we can control their human and business impacts. And we one key to this is carrying out what we call public health surveillance. In order to understand where we in public health and where the community should really focus its efforts, we need to understand what the nature of the problem is, how big it is, and where it's distributed. And currently, we don't really know that. There's no reporting, and there are some serious disincentives to reporting because of the reputational harm that happens. And Ben will talk about solutions for that. We also bring stakeholders together to collaborate on solutions, share ideas, share best practices, provide support to each other in carrying out education and outreach in the community. So there is some real significant issues with privacy here, and that's really what Ben is going to talk with you about and why we're here with our asks. So thank you very much.
So I'll start because our story is really one of responding.
Introduce yourself.
Ben Dungan, Multnomah County Health Department. Our story is really, and our history is really about responding and creating leadership around this issue. And as early as 2005, we began hearing from communities and from our housing partners, and especially around the impact of infestations, and Dr. Oxman described some of those. In response, we developed a website, we developed some educational materials, we began holding forums throughout the state. Really, there were opportunities for people to share and discuss their problems, their experiences, what was working, and best practices that people were already identifying. In 2009, as a result of that, we formed a citizen bedbug advisory group, which was, again, primarily housing and transitional housing folks. They were really sharing stories and information, but nothing too formal. Because of that, we've kind of created this two-pronged approach. One, that the community would assume leadership of this, what I call a de facto task force, that continued to share information and best practices. And then the government, Multnomah County, going in a different direction to really address gaps, create policies, and really coordinate a countywide response. Over the last year, starting in 2011, we convened a bedbug summit that brought together folks from housing and schools and childcare, lodging, public health, pest control operators, and other folks that really started the work towards a regional strategy. The resulting in the formation of a steering committee and a bedbug work group. So it's a chartered work group that's going to be meeting for two years. We've just completed our first year from 2011-2012. July was our kind of annual report. Over that first year, we developed a framework for surveillance, so we have a database. We've met and partnered with our pest control operators that are participating on the work group. We have a hotline that's a live line, so if you call, you actually reach Ben Duncan if you call 988-BUGS. I'll just say we've had, since March, without doing a lot of education and outreach, we've actually had about 80 calls to the hotline, so it's a direct line, and that doesn't include any calls that come through just the main Multnomah County number. We've expanded our website, including having good referral and links to some of the national sites, including Environmental Protection Agency and University of Minnesota. We've done some training and education and outreach, primarily using interns, because it's kind of been, in some ways, an unfunded mandate for environmental health to deal with this issue. So we've kind of stretched our resources by using students and other community partners. And then, of course, we submitted our first annual report that we're happy to make available if folks are interested. But today, really, we're specifically looking at this legislative proposal, and as Dr. Oxman talked about, you know, one of the first questions we often get is, you know, how bad is the problem? Or what's the, you know, how worried should I be? And we really don't have a real structured way to answer that question. So what we're hoping today, because of that critical importance of understanding the scope, and because our pest control operators really want to and are willing to voluntarily report data, but they need to be assured that it's confidential because of their proprietary and business interests, because of their honor of client confidentiality, and because they want to be protected that, you know, a records request doesn't come in and we divulge all of this information. So specifically, we're looking for you to create legislation that would protect pest control operator reports to public health departments for public health analysis. So the proposed legislation would protect from public disclosure the property owner's identity, the location where the application occurred, and any visual representation of evidence of infestation. And because this information is voluntary, we want to avoid having operators withhold any information out of concern that sensitive information about their clients would be released publicly by public health. The purpose of the proposed legislation is to encourage disclosure of this critical public information to public health departments only. So with that, I'll ask if you have any questions. We're happy to answer them.
Are there any questions? Do you have an LC ready?
We do, and we can submit it to the committee administrator.
Please. You say you don't know the answer, but let me ask you a question again. How big a problem is it?
thanks, Chair.
You have an opinion.
I mean, I think anecdotally we can see it growing. I mean, I think we've seen over since that initial kind of community community bring it to us in 2005, we've seen more housing partners dealing with it. We're getting more calls from the community, and we can see where it can go. But I will also say that we've seen some great efforts from our housing partners that are creating best practices, that are reducing costs of infestation through monitoring and through awareness and education for their tenants. So while I do feel the problem's growing, I don't think, as Dr. Oxman alluded to, we're not at the level of a New York City. There's a lot of other cities dealing with it much more harmful way than Portland is. But obviously, when we think of, you know, the 30, 40, 50,000 students at Oregon State and University of Oregon and Portland State and our travel and tourism along the coast and, you know, things like Shakespeare Festival in Ashland and the Roundup and Pendleton, I mean, we can see where the potential risks can be for the state. And so by understanding the scope of the problem, by understanding trends, we can really allocate resources effectively to deal with the problem.
If a hotel gets an infestation, can it clean it up?
Yeah, so I mean, the good thing about bed bugs is you can kill them. I mean, with proper response and proactive prevention, the problem can be dealt with. And, you know, I do get calls on the hotline often to say, well, I'm coming to Portland, where should I stay?
I was going to ask you, I'm going to New York, where should I stay?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer. And I think when we think of hotels, you know, the fact that a hotel doesn't have bed bugs today does not ensure that they don't have them tomorrow. And the fact that they had them yesterday doesn't mean that they have them today. So oftentimes when I talk to folks, it's really about, you know, if you can call the hotel and they have a proactive policy, they're acknowledging that there's a potential issue and they have dealt with it appropriately, I think you can feel more comfortable. You can also visit our website, and then there's a link, and also University of Minnesota, that has a how to inspect your hotel room. So you kind of get a little neurotic, but you'll find the places to look and the ways that you can identify them.
Well, thank you very much for telling me. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm wondering how many calls you get on your hotline and whether you want us to advertise your telephone number in our newsletter.
So, Chair, Representative, well, the calls, I mean, it really varies, and we'll see it. If, you know, if the Oregonian does a story, the calls will spike. I'm happy to answer the calls as they come in. If you want a link to your website or whatever mechanism you feel, it's really meant to be a community resource. It's really meant to answer those questions that are very difficult to ask, and often people don't know where to go. So it's a great resource. We're really proud of it, and however you want to get the word out, we're happy to answer them.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we are adjourned. Thank you for hanging in a little over.